Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woozy Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irritable Shag. Along with me is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
Well, howdy, neighbor. How y'all doing?
You know, we did kind of tell the people last time that we might be recording together in person. We are not, mainly because of the restraining order. But really, that more than anything, that was a hint that Rob would be moving for you people at home. You may not have realized it at the time, but Rob was hinting at that. And where are you now, sir?
I am now in your state of Florida, sir.
It is not my state of Florida. It is our state, sir. You got your license.
That is true. I am a Florida man at this point. I'm running around shirtless with a giant flag in the back of my pickup truck. I feel like I'm blending right in.
There we go. Or as we prefer to call ourselves, floor idiots. So welcome to the club. But on the flip side, you can wear shorts in April. So how's that?
I have not worn long pants since the last day of March. This is glorious.
It is really nice. It's actually, we're already starting to edge towards the, damn, it's hot today kind of moment. Like when you're out in the sun, it's like, oh, man, I need a break.
I am not going to complain. I'm not.
You better not. Enough about the weather. Let's talk about who's who, buddy. So we're behind schedule. Is that right?
A little bit. We've been trying to do these every 2 months. We missed April. But to make up for it, you're getting the royal audience here, two episodes in May.
Yeah, so this episode of Who's Who Review is going to happen. Then later this month, you'll be getting a Justice League International Who's Who flashback episode featuring tons of clips from past shows where we covered JLI Who's Who entries. Now, in that JLI flashback episode, I've got a special treat for you. Not only will it be a bunch of old clips, but we will have a brand new clip for you there. Where we'll be covering a brand new Zoom's Who entry compiled by Zoom's son, Osamu Yukinori. And it is an amazing piece, folks. And I can't say what it is yet. As we get closer, you'll start to see it on social media, and then we'll talk about it on the episode. But it is an entry that was sorely missed in the original Loose Leaf Who's Who. So you'll definitely want to check back for that JLI flashback episode.
Reminder, folks, of the premise of the Who's Who Review Show. I know that was the stage notes. I wasn't supposed to read that, but I just felt like saying it anyway.
Nice segue, Rob.
Pause for dramatic effect. No, of course, this for anyone. By the way, the reason we didn't do one in April is my fault because, as aforementioned, I was moving. There was just no way. I took a whole like 3 weeks off from recording to actually drive all the way down to Florida and get set up. So that's why we missed an April show. So apologies, everybody. But yes, the premise of the show is we're going through 13 entries from the classic Who's Who series of the original 26 book run. And we're just sort of looking at them with fresh yet still older eyes kind of thing. I mean, times change. We might feel a little bit differently about them. Of course, the characters have changed. All of them have appeared on television or in movies. That's something we can guarantee. And so we just thought, it'd be kind of fun to just randomly dig out some old entries and see what we think of them in the year of our Lord 2024.
And we picked the classic Who's Who because, I mean, that's the series we're most passionate about. Like, I have a lot of love for the other volumes, especially Loose Leaf. But the original Who's Who, it's the original. It's kind of hard to beat. And there's also, it's the most amount of characters. So what we did is we indexed every single entry in the original Who's Who, which is 819 entries, by the way. And we use a randomizer every episode to select 13 random numbers, and we choose those entries. And so that's what we're doing here today. You're getting 13, plus you're going to get, at the end, you're going to get a Zoom's Who entry as well. Not the one that's going to be in JLI, a different one. But either way, we're going to have a little bit of fun. I'm looking forward to it. But before we do all that, Rob, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Who's Who is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collections, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, this time out, I picked Stargirl, The Lost Children, which is a very recent miniseries just from last year by Jeff Johns and Todd Nock. And Todd Nock is such an amazing artist. I could just stare at panels by him all day long, and I would be happy as a clam. And we actually covered this miniseries on a recent episode of JSA Presents. myself and Sean Ross. And it's a Stargirl adventure. It collects the Stargirl Spring Break Special and the Stargirl Lost Children miniseries of six issues. Basically, it has to do with a bunch of teenage sidekicks that have been lost to history. Some of them legit Golden Age sidekicks, some retroactively created by Geoff Johns right then and there. And so it's a whole bunch of teenage sidekicks fighting for their freedom. And by the end, well, there's just a bit of a spoiler in there, but I won't tell you the spoiler. Either way, it ends in a very satisfying way. Let's just put it that way. And full page count is 192 pages. It's full color and it's a soft cover. Normally goes for $16.99, but you can get it for 42% off. So it's $9.85. And the whole reason I picked it is one of the characters we're going to talk about today is featured pretty prominently in the Stargirl The Lost Children miniseries.
Yeah, based on an entry, of course, in this episode, I picked Justice League of America Last Survivors of Earth trade paperback. It's by Denny O'Neill, Dick Dillon, Joe Giella. It reprints JLA numbers 77 through 84, 86 through 92, and 94, 95. And if you're worrying why, you're wondering why are the two issues excluded, 85 and 93 were all reprint issues, so there's nothing to collect in this trade from those issues. One of the reasons I picked it, A, like I said, it's because it's a JLA entry, and we'll be talking about them soon, but it features the most insane trade dress I've ever seen on a DC collected edition. It is so overstuffed and I love it. And I almost can't believe that that's the actual cover to this thing. It's just so overloaded. There's a little blurb, Flash's final hour, which of course not true. It's just, like I said, I got to see this book because I can't believe that this is the actual cover. Two of the stories that it talks about are the one where the Snapper Carr betrays the Justice League. Cause of course he does. Cause he's a giant dick. And he's terrible. And the JLA gets their satellite. They move from the cave to the satellite. So big, big doings going on. The normal price is $39.99. It's 416 pages, but in stock trades price is only $23.19. You save 42%.
You know what that cover looks like? It looks like, as I'm looking at it right now, it looks like one of those old, when they would do the 100-page giants or something. And they,
it does. Just
fill the cover with a bunch of crap.
It's just so overfilled. I love it. I can't believe that they actually let that go by. I hope that that's what it actually looks like in the printed version.
Well, I'm sure it's absolutely on purpose, you know, to try and emulate those old covers. And that is an absolute hoot. That is super fun. I love that. And so if those are the Denny O'Neill issues, then there's got to be some great Aquaman action in there, right?
Number 94 actually features Aquaman in like front and center in the story, drawn by in a couple of pages in the book by Neil Adams. It's drawn, the whole book is Dick Dillon, but then for some reason there's like four pages drawn by Neil Adams. So you get that in there too. It's great stuff.
Dang, I was going for a joke. That didn't work because didn't Denny O'Neill, wasn't he the one that forgot Aquaman?
Yeah, Denny O'Neill literally did forget. Although you'll be excited about this, Gord Dalton. This does feature a guest appearance by Vigilante.
No way. That's very exciting. I hope the Troubadour sings in it.
Yeah, Dispenser of Prairie Justice.
Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is sponsored also in part with your Patreon support because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. Our thanks go out to Damian Drew A. Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Mike Atchison, Nathan Archer, Tom Panarese,
Gord Tolton, Charles Coletta, Jack Dower, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Noah Tarnow, and Tom Perrine.
Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. Now, for these 13 entries, or 14 with the additional one, we will post these on our website over on the Fire and Water Podcast Network on a gallery post. And be sure to leave your comments on our website because that's what we cover on these shows, guys, is comments from our website. So that's where you want to leave your thoughts. And check this out, Rob. I looked at who all some of the artists are that we're going to be talking about today. This is amazing. What a lineup here. Thank you, Randomizer, for giving us the glory that is Jack Kirby, Gil Kane, Eduardo Barreto, Dan Jurgens, your favorite, Todd McFarlane, Klaus Janson, Steve Bissett, Scott Shaw, Luke McDonald, Romeo Tangal, and more. I mean, it's just amazing. Unbelievable. So, all right, with that, let's get into our first entry, all right?
Okay.
Hi, Rob. Fire up the randomizer. First up is the Atom. Yes, we're talking Ray Palmer, the original Atom. So this entry comes from issue number one of the Who's Who. And the art here is by Gil Kane. And in the foreground, what you've got is you've got the Atom. You've actually have two images of the Atom, really. On the left, you've got the, at this point, contemporary Sword of the Atom version of him. So he's kind of in a leaping pose. He's got a sword raised above his head. He's got a hand outstretched, very action-oriented. And then the other foreground image is of him in his classic costume holding the... what do you call those pens?
It's like a quill pen kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, thank you.
Not quill pen, excuse me, but like, yeah, I actually forget what you actually call it, but it's like an ink
cartridge.
Pen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the kind of pen you dip into a bottle of ink and then you
yep. use. And this is from a famous, that image, I'm pretty sure it's from a famous cover, if I recall. But anyway, and then in the surprint, you've got a face, a picture of Ray with his mask off, which is always, again, remember the classic surprint always had the character with the mask off. You've got Jean Loring, his wife there. And then on the left-hand side, it took me a minute to realize who that was, but that's Princess Lethwain, and I'm probably saying her name wrong. That's his beloved alien space six-inch hive princess that he fell in love with. And without their yellow skin and the red hair, it's a little hard to realize who she is. Mm-hmm. She just looks like any generic, you know, 1970s chick. But before we get into the entries, so let's talk about the art. So what do you think, buddy?
Well, you mentioned something that I was actually noticed this time. I don't think we mentioned it the first time. I'm not going back and listening to this old episode. Is this is the oldest and the only entry I can think of that features two versions of the character, both in color. Right, I don't think they ever did that again. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, 900 listings.
I was gonna say, hang on, I'm gonna go check the 800.
Yeah, let's flip through the entire book. Atari Force. No, but I mean, I really think I almost wonder, since this was in the first issue, they didn't after this establish the like quote unquote rule that they weren't going to do that anymore. Because if you don't know the Atom, and you know who doesn't, anyone who's reading who cared enough to read Who's Who knows who the Atom is. It could look like there are two Atoms. There's mm-hmm. one that looks like this and one that looks like that. That is not at all intended as a criticism of the master, Gil Kane, because you could argue, well, look, this is how he looked for 30 years. We shouldn't relegate that to a surprint just because his current iteration, which might, for all we know, we're going to last another year, is this other version and, like, you know, make it look sort of impermanent. So it makes total sense why you would do it, though. But it occurred to me, I don't think there's another entry where two iterations of the character are both in color, making them look like they are the present version as opposed to the
yeah.
script, which is always the past.
Well, and I think this actually comes down to the colorist, because now that I look at this closer, I didn't notice on Jean Loring's shoulder is the ink bottle that goes with that
yes.
pen.
Yeah.
And so I bet when this was designed, either they hadn't decided about the surprint idea, because again, like you said, this is issue number one, guys, or when Gil did it, he intended for the original Ray Palmer to be in the surprint. Could have been. And the colorist made the decision to make it, you know, full color. I don't know.
Yeah.
Either way, it's and I thank you for mentioning Gil Kane. I don't know that I did mention him. It's a great piece. I mean, I've said some things positive and negative about Gil Kane in the 80s. This is freaking stunning, guys. This
yeah,
is absolutely
beautiful.
Gorgeous. So I have a lot to say here. And so I'm going to just go right into this. So Sword of the Atom. I love, 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 love the Sword of the Atom stuff. The concept, all of it, the sword and the sorcery, the costume alterations. So the costume alterations is they opened up the cowl. So he's got his hair exposed. His boots are all, you know, more cloth-based, not tight, skin-tight stuff. He's got this awesome belt, you know, giant, you know, almost like wrestler belt. He's got a loincloth, and he's got, like, necklaces and bracelets and the sword. It just looks right. Like, when I look at that version of the Atom, I'm like, yeah, damn, that's what he should look like. And as far as I'm concerned, the Sword of the Atom version, this was the post-crisis update just a few years early. You know, everyone else got an update. Everyone else got a refresh. This should have been the post-crisis Atom. They should have never gone back. They should have kept it this way. I mean, what good comes of going back to the old stuff, right? I mean, Power of the Atom series, nobody cares. Nobody cared about that show. I mean, that series. Even Ryan Choi, who I love as a character, no one wanted to buy his book. No one's buying a DC book about a shrinking guy, period. Atom couldn't even support his own book back in the day. They had to combine it with Hawkman in the 60s. So no one's buying the Atom book. So why struggle to fit him back in the iconic version when nobody, even in the JLA, they weren't doing anything interesting with him? Here, as the Sword of the Atom, he is interesting. Leave him that way. He could have been like DC's version of Kazar. You know, where he's like out in the savage and land and every once in a while teams up with a superhero or something like that. They should have kept it this way. Now, tell me I'm right or I'm wrong. You tell me.
I mean, no offense to Kazar. Did DC need a version of Kazar? Was he really setting the world on fire sales-wise? No, I agree. They were clearly across the board at this time. DC was freshening up all of their secondary characters. Aquaman, Green Arrow, the Atom, Shadow War of Hawkman, the Red Tornado miniseries. I mean, they were just doing that for virtual. I mean, of course, they eventually did it for everybody. But pre-crisis, they were trying to freshen up everybody with giving them new concept, maybe new costumes, new concepts. I haven't read Sword of the Atom in decades, so I don't know if it holds up. I remember loving it at the time. I bought it and thought, oh, this is really fun. And, you know, it was, and it made me, I have to say, like, when I think about it, it makes me sad to think about that, like, because it opens with him catching Jean cheating on him. And that's what sort of drives the thing. And, you know, next, because she was already trouble enough. But it's just almost like, I feel bad that Adam just kind of like didn't, like, none of his JLA buddies like talked him through this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he just kind of disappears into the jungle. And I mean, there's a comment about it in an issue of JLA where Elongated Man is like, yeah, Ray's just disappeared. I'm like, this makes me so sad. Like, you know, but no, I thought it was a great concept. And Jan Strenad was the writer and Gil Kane was the artist. I thought it was really cool.
I just reread it this week because I got so excited by this entry. I reread that and I watched the cartoon adaptations, which, by the way, that's another thing that tells me I'm right. That, because I mean, because I need that, you know, affirmation, but that they should have stuck with Sword of the Atom. Because if you look at the animated stuff they've done, you know, DC Nation did those animated shorts. They're like little 1 minute shorts that was based on Power of the Atom. Then you fast forward to Batman Brave and the Bold. They did an episode about Ray Palmer. It was also based on Sword of the Atom. So even people nowadays see, if you're going to make Ray Palmer work, that's the way to go. Now, Legends of Tomorrow, you know, Brandon Routh played Ray Palmer. I don't know if you know that or not. But really, he was Blue Beetle with shrinking powers. I mean, that's really what it was. They were really making a Blue Beetle. Ted Kord is really what they were going for, but it was technically Ray Palmer. Either way, this is the version that I think works, because otherwise he just becomes a generic shrinking character that nobody cares about. And reading the entry, I mean, it's sort of funny. Like, it says in here about their split up. You know, you just mentioned she, you know, caught her cheating, but it's like certain events led to the couple separation. Yeah, because she was stooping her business partner. That's why, right?
Well, then Jean had a history of being a giant pain in the ass as a side character. I mean, you just did.
Well, there's this great line here, too, that says, you know, Ray battled crime to help his lady love, Jean Loring, establish herself as a lawyer so she would agree to marry him. Think that through, folks. He helped her so she could establish herself as a lawyer and that she would marry him. Read between the lines. Ray Palmer became the Atom to get laid. Like, for real. That is exactly what they're saying. And then also, it tells me that she was a terrible lawyer if she needed a superhero to solve her cases for her. So all the way around, interesting information. For more on Atom, you can check out the Power of the Atom podcast by our buddy Diablo Frank. He puts out once every 7 years. You can watch Legends of Tomorrow, kind of, sort of. Again, Batman Brave and the Bold, Sword of the Atom, and the DC Nation shorts about Sword of the Atom, which I didn't realize till today. They never finished them. They did four little episodes, they never did the rest. So it kind of left me on a cliffhanger. I mean, I know how the story goes. It was an adaptation, but still.
I didn't even know they existed until you sent me the links. I had no idea. And by the way, I just mentioned the first one where he encounters the snake. The snake looks exactly like the snake that Gil Kane drew.
Yeah, I know.
Which I thought was great. Like, they just took the Gil Kane drawing and animated it, which I thought was just really great.
It was a faithful adaptation, too. Yeah. It really was, because I just read it, you know. And so first appearance is Showcase number 34, by the way. So at this point, you know, Ray had appeared in the 1983 miniseries, Sword of the Atom. And then he gets three specials. In 1984, he gets a special. In 1985, he gets a special. In 1988, he gets a special. So, again, I think this was a great idea. Establish the character, have him show up once in a blue moon, and just keep him out there. Why bring him back? So I wish Ray was still in the Sword of the Atom. All right.
All right. Next up, The Construct. who first appeared in Justice League of America number 142. He's basically a giant computer that can access sort of all the world's electronics and take them over. And it's listed here. Occupation would be world conqueror, which is what we refer to Siskoid as. And it's funny because this is a creation of writer Steve Englehart, because that was during the year Englehart was writing the book. And it's funny to think that, like, And now he comes back in the Red Tornado miniseries. Now, of course, then he's able to infiltrate computers. But this is like Construct was just there a little too early, because this, his two major appearances are just before the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Just before, right? Because he appears in JLA 142, which is like 1977. And then he comes back in the Red Tornado miniseries. As I said, that's 1985. So like, there, you know, yes, there was kind of like the nascent internet. Thank you, Al Gore. But like, nobody knew about it in 1985. So it's like, this is a concept that just a little ahead of its time, which of course made it interesting, because you were like, wow, a guy that can access all electronics. But like, there's a scene in like the JLA annual where Red Tornado gets sort of infused with the Construct's power, yada, yada, yada. And you, Red Tornado uses like a bank sign to communicate with Kathy, which is just really funny. Yeah, he becomes kind of like the Red Tornado villain in the miniseries, the Red Tornado. And he's written by Kurt Busiek. Unfortunately, or not for, maybe not unfortunately, by the way, it's drawn by Howard Bender and Bill Ray. And Bill Ray, of course, famous anchor, mostly a humor anchor, did a lot of Mad Magazine. So Construct looks kind of goofy.
He
looks like the kind of robot that if you want to make fun of him, he's like meep more, like he's that kind of robot. And so he's never been all that terrifying. Nevertheless, you know, hey, he's a cool JLA villain.
Well, the Serpent's nice. You know, it shows him, you know, it shows like TVs and radios and stuff, and him blasting out of them with his little minions. And then you see the JLA fighting him. So like you mentioned those issues, right? You know, 142, 143, 146, Red Tornado. Then he appears, believe it or not, in the Justice League International book. He shows up in issue 11.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, he shows up in issue 11, right before Maxwell Lord gets outed as being controlled by Metron's computers. And the weird thing is, near as I can tell, there's like a 20-year break where he doesn't show up again until Kurt Busiek brings him back in the JLA, which blows my mind because of everything you just said, right? I mean, that's when the internet was happening, and they waited 20 years to bring him back. Because, I mean, as goofy as this is, it really is. Like, if you read it, it's today, man. It is very cool. It is modern. It is edgy. Like, I see that, and I'm like, oh, man, I bet there are some badass, you know, DC stories to the Construct right now. At least there should be. All about AI. And,
yeah, that's right. That's what we're worried about now is AI. Yeah.
I mean, this is perfect, but I don't know that they've done much with it. I didn't see a lot. And then again, my eyes start to glaze over when you get past 2011. But Kurt Busiek did do some cool things with him. I didn't think about the connection there. Kurt Busiek wrote Red Tornado, and then he's the one who brought Construct back for his run on JLA. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, you know, it's not even worth it, but, well, all right, fine, I'll say it because I'm a JLA guy. I can't stop. So I mentioned he was in JLI number 11. Well, then in 1995, the writer of the Justice League at that point retconned that whole thing to say it was controlled by Kilgore. So if you ever look up the Construct, it is deeply sewn together with Kilgore, and I just say that's a bunch of crap. I don't pay any attention to that stuff. By the way, this enters from issue number 5 of Who's Who. We should mention that. And again, super goofy art for a character that is really freaking interesting. And I would love to see some cool stories by him today. And folks, you know, you, those of you listening that read modern comics, let us know some cool modern Construct issues to read, and I'll go check them out, because I think very, very timely character. All right. Up next is Dawnstar. From issue number 6 to Who's Who, drawn by James Sherman. So you've got a fairly small figure of Dawnstar. Dawnstar. She's only about a third of the size of the page, but she's flying. It looks like she's coming in for a landing. Perhaps she's got her. She's if you don't know her, she is like a space Native American with like wings like Angel. So she's flying and she's getting ready. It looks like she's getting ready to land because she's got like 1 foot extended and her wings are out and her hair's, you know, being flapping in the wind. Then in the Serpent, there is a gorgeous picture of her, close up of her face, just stunningly beautiful. There's a great shot of her flying in the background. Like you can see the speed lines on her wings, and there's like concentric circles, like she's Aquaman talking to fish, but in reality, she's tracking people. And then you see who I have to assume are her parents. I believe there's two alien, one's an alien, one's not there. And let's just talk about the art first. I think this is gorgeous. Again, it's a little strange that the main figure is smaller, but it makes so much more room for that beautiful profile shot in the back. What do you think of this?
Yeah, except for the figure and the logo being a little small, and there being kind of a lot of dead space on like the upper left and the bottom right. This is beautifully drawn by James Sherman. I mean, I'm not familiar with him outside of his work on Legion. Like, I knew that he did that. That's why he's drawing this, right? Didn't he have a run on the book?
I actually didn't do the research on that, so
I
I don't
think he
know.
did. Yeah, I think that he did. But boy, is it, and he inked it too. He penciled it and inked it. I love his ink line. They're really, really thick lines. I love the, again, the shot of his, her super cool hippy dippy parents, Moonwalker and Mist Rider, which is just fantastic. Yeah, this is really a really great piece. I love the darkness on the wings. Just everything about his ink line is just absolutely gorgeous. And I like that on the feathers, there's some slight fluttering because it's like it's in motion. So just I again, just the design I think has a little bit left to be desired, but the draftsmanship is really top notch.
It's a nice combination of beautiful and sexy because she's alluring too. Just her co the very nature of her costume is kind of sexy, but just beautifully stunning face. Just you kind of almost catch your breath. She's so beautiful. So the gist of Dawnstar is she's a Legion of Superheroes character. So she's talking 30th century here. She is again space Native American, and she's a tracker and a bounty hunter, and she can like fly through space unaided. And when she joined the Legion, eventually after being in the Academy, her and Wildfire became romantically connected. Now it was platonic because Wildfire can't, get it on. But so it was this very platonic, long-spanning love affair, and it was kind of like the power couple of the Legion for a long time. And at the point of this writing, though, it looks like there's a love triangle forming with some other character. I think that was probably just a temporary thing. But the only downside I would say to this entry is, first of all, there's not a lot of text, but there's nothing in here that really gives you a sense of her personality. Which is sort of sad because I like it when you get a sense of someone's personality. And I actually have very, very little personal experience with her as a reader because I came in during the 5YL era. And in that era, she's around, but not a lot. And she's actually, it's complicated. She's a bad guy, kind of sort of being possessed by this bounty hunter, and her wings have been amputated.
Oh my God.
Well, I mean,
Everything,
it happened to Angel.
everything I hear about the era of Legion, I just, why? Just
So good.
why?
It's so good.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. You never read it. Shut up, you. Anyway, so she had her wings amputated. Angel had his wings amputated about the same time. So I guess it was in the air. I don't know. But then after 1995, they do the reboot, and she's pretty much back to normal. She's back to this version of her. But you don't see her as often as a Legionnaire. And I don't know if that's because the writers just had other plans for her, or if maybe they felt it was a little culturally insensitive. I don't know. That could have been what that was. But at this point, the Legion was on the Baxter Legion series, issue number 13, and Tales of the Legion had finally reached number one of the Baxter series because that was a reprint book. After a year, it becomes a reprint book.
What a cockamamie idea that was.
It worked. So they had two books on the shelves. So her first appearance was Superboy 225. So that's back before it was, the Legion of Superheroes book. She premiered back in those days. And if you want more on her, she's in a couple of animated movies about the Legion. You can find more of her on the Legion of Super Bloggers. I think she's a fascinating character, and I just wish I knew a little more about her. Maybe there you go. There's something you guys could put in the comments. What are some fantastic Dawnstar issues to read that will make us care about the character? Like, I mean, she's in Crisis, right? Out of all the Legion characters, she was one of the ones they picked to be a featured character in Crisis because obviously she had enough either cachet or was interesting enough visually, whatever it was, that they picked her for Crisis. But what are some good stories to read, folks? Let us know.
How do wings work in space, by the way?
We don't ask those questions, Rob.
Okay. All right. Okay.
How do people talk to fish? I mean, come on, whatever.
That's just science, but okay.
Oh my
All
God.
right. So, all right. Next up is Electrocutioner, who actually, if you've never heard of this character, who I don't think I had by the time I got this, actually might be a good candidate for who's that. Is if you have even and if you haven't read the entry, which is very much like something I would do, you think he's a villain, and he's an anti-hero, but he starts out as a guy who's killing criminals with his electrical power who have, as in his eyes, escaped the law. So he's not a villain, like he's stealing things or he's doing some nefarious thing and then he encounters Batman. That's where he first appears, Batman number 331. He's actually somebody who is sort of, he's like a Punisher. He's like the further version of Batman. And of course, he runs afoul of Batman. And then later on, he encounters the Vigilante. And we see that on the surprint. This listing is drawn by David Ross and Klaus Janson. He looks really cool. Like his costume is just all red and black, except for these yellow gloves because they're like bristling with electricity. He looks great. I mean, again, he's drawn by Ross and especially Klaus Janson. And so maybe he didn't look quite so cool in Batman 331. I don't know. I don't remember who was drawing Batman at that era in the book. Although that might have, well, wait a minute. Hold on. 331. That's probably Irv Novik. which means he probably looks pretty cool.
Actually, it was. I actually have a note that he's created by Marv Wolfman, Michael Fleischer, and Herb Novick.
Michael Fleischer. Okay. So there you go. So he probably looked really cool. So, yeah, I kind of feel like this guy should be maybe like a bigger character because he looks really neat. I like the idea of, he's a Punisher. That's always a great character to introduce to your hero of like, he's the extreme version. I love the idea of like the vigilante trying to like, you know, morally shame this guy, you know, the vigilante's out there putting bullets into people's skulls, but it's like, no, not like that. Like this kind of way. That's just absolutely ridiculous.
He's spinning the nunchucks, so he's going to teach him a lesson with the nunchucks.
Exactly. By the way, I love the poses there. They were really, really captivating. So this is a character that probably only appeared maybe twice, three times. You could argue, you know, maybe he didn't really even deserve a listing, but I think, by the way, occupation, killer.
that's the same as you, right? Killer.
Does that come with medical benefits? But anyway, no, that's one of the things I love Who's Who for, is giving us a character that most people didn't know. Having him being drawn by some top flight artists. And I don't know, this guy should be a bigger deal in the DCU, I think.
Well, he looks really cool. He really, really does. Great. And at some point, the Vigilante book was a hot book. I don't know if it was at this point. At this point, Vigilante, the book was on issue 21. So I don't know when its star was shining and when it was waxing and waning or whatever. I don't know. But so I got to think, you know, Electrocutioner was a character that DC kind of had their eye on, especially with Punisher. You know, by this point, Mike Zeck was probably doing the Punisher miniseries because this is issue 7 of Who's Who. So we're pretty far into 1985. So maybe they thought they had something here. And it's interesting you mentioned the character should be a bigger deal. Well, he dies, I believe, in the Vigilante series, I think. Maybe Marv Wolfman felt it was okay to do that because he helped create the character, so maybe he figured he'd get in the character. But you get more versions of the Electrocutioner as time goes by, 1991 and 1992. In fact, the third Electrocutioner is actually this guy's brother, so they
okay.
Have a connection there. But you talk about being a bigger deal. So he has had cameos apparently on Justice League Unlimited, which I don't remember, but he had a cameo on Justice League Unlimited.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Apparently he's been a character on the TV show Gotham.
God.
I know. I don't know how major, though. I don't know if he was just, you know, referenced or was like, you know, a big deal. I don't know. And then Batman Bad Blood, which I guess is an animated thing. It sounds like he was a character there. And he's been in a bunch of video games. So he has had a shelf life out there. So sort of a change.
Cool.
Klaus Janson in 1985, yes, please give me more of that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I'm good with that. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great listing. It really, there's not much to say about him. There's right. only a couple of paragraphs, but nevertheless, it's a great piece.
Yep. All right, on to the Floronic Man from issue number 8 of Who's Who. This is drawn by Stephen Bissette. And lots to say here. So, you know, here, Stephen Bissette has drawn him, you know, he's all in his tree-like glory. You know, his skin is like a brown bark, and he's got all kinds of greenery on, like, his shoulders and around his nether regions and his calves and his wrists. So they use the greenery like a superhero costume, essentially is what they're doing, with the skin being wood. And then he's got all these branches kind of growing out of his face and green moss for his hair and red eyes. And he looks like he's like, hey, you're going to come to the party. You know, looks like we're free beer. It's like what he's shouting. And then he's got all these tendrils growing underneath him. Then in the serpent, you've got his original face as the plant master. And then you've got the Floronic Man, you know, evil maniacal face next to it. You see him in one panel fighting the Atom in his original plant master mode, which basically just looks like a dude. Looks like Grand Moff Tarkin. And then on the right hand side, you see him fighting the Swamp Thing. So just starting off on the art, what you think?
It's superb, Steve. It's funny that it's Bissette by himself, not Bissette and Todelbin, who were the art team on Swamp Thing. And the reason he's here, I mean, look, he was a recurring villain. I don't mean to dismiss him because he was in, as you mentioned, he was in the Atom book. I mean, he's the Atom number one. He's the first mm-hmm. villain, and he then appeared in your and my one of our favorite JLA JSA team ups 195 mm-hmm. through 197, and he's in that book. But it was really. It was his use in Saga of the Swamp Thing where they really turned him into this demented, complete and utter lunatic that I think is reason he is as famous as he is, at least at this point. He would go on to greater fame. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think the reason that he's drawn by Bissette and then he's in here. Well, he was always going to be in here. But I think the reason he's in here drawn by Bissette is that, you know, the Swamp Thing people have kind of claimed him as
one of the absolutely. Villains. If I could change anything in the art, just his face in the foreground. I don't know. He just looks almost silly, like the face part of it. Like the face in the background looks great and scary. But the face in the foreground, again, it just looks like he's like, hey, guys, it's good to see you. But so the history here on the character, first appearance, as you mentioned, is Adam number one, all the way back to 1962. I didn't realize he was an Adam villain, right? Like off the top of my head, I should have, but I just didn't remember that. So the story is he comes from another dimension that has crap like wood nymphs and stuff, right? He's exiled to Earth, and he uses, even though he looks like a regular dude, he's exiled to Earth, uses his knowledge to control plants, and tries to conquer America. But he's beaten by the Atom, Ray Palmer, in the 60s. So clearly he's a real scary threat, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, he eventually gets transformed into the Floronic Man. Happens in a Flash issue, which is actually a Green Lantern backup. So he goes on, he fights Green Lantern, he fights Wonder Woman, as you mentioned, the Secret Society of Supervillains, and that Justice League issue. And then, yes, Swamp Thing, Alan Moore adopts him. And I didn't necessarily remember where it was he got adopted, but they brought him in specifically for the anatomy lesson. He's the person that uncovers, sorry, spoilers, that Swamp Thing is not a man that walks like a plant. He's a plant that walks like a man. Mm-hmm. So he's the one who is part of the anatomy lesson. So that's another reason it becomes such a big deal, is because that's such a big issue. And then he ends up sort of connecting with Swamp Thing and connecting with the entire plant kingdom, or as we'll eventually call it, the Green. And yeah, once that link is broken, that's what drives him insane. He ends up in Arkham. Later on, they do a retcon, which said that he taught botany back in the day in college. He, as a professor, he taught to Alec Holland and Pamela Isley, so sort of connecting him with all the different plant characters. Then Millennium happens, and that is still such the weirdest thing, that this crazy-ass villain becomes a hero and starts calling himself Floro. And he was a hero for a while there. And that's just messed up. That's weird. Because like, if you know the history of this dude, you're like, no, not that guy. And he's had a zillion appearances since. Because, I mean, I guess Millennium made him a real household name. Eventually.
Did you hear yourself? Did you just hear that sentence?
I did it on purpose.
Millennium made him a household name.
I did. I'm glad I got the laugh I was aiming for.
What? I love. What color is the sky in your world, Shag?
Hey, we're in the same state. Watch out. eventually, he changes his name to The Cedar, which is like you know, seeds, like plant. Yeah, it's a bad name. I think you could just go by Jason Woodrow and be done with it. That'd be fine. It's a great name.
Not really just good. Woodrow. I think just Woodrow. That has a weird, you know, like, okay, what does that mean? And it's got the wood in there. So it works by itself.
So at this point, Swamp Thing number 41 is on the shelf. So it's about 20 issues after the anatomy lesson where, you know, where Woodrow became a big deal. Do you realize how much stuff he's in? Like out extra media stuff. I had no idea until I started looking at it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know of one and it's related to I have one and it's related to a question I have for everyone in the audience that I want them to answer.
All right.
Okay. So of course he is played by John Glover.
Okay. That's one
in Batman and Robin playing Professor Jason Woodrow. He doesn't ever turn into the Floronic Man or whatever, but nevertheless, he is Jason Woodrow and he's sort of the creator of Poison Ivy, which is actually kind of clever. You know, combining them together, it makes sort of sense. So, of course, now putting aside what you think about that movie, nevertheless, it's wow, that's cool. It's the Floronic Man is making a sideways appearance in a live action movie. 1997, that was still pretty amazing. So, okay, in August, there will be the Tampa Comic Con, and John Glover is a guest at the Tampa Comic Con. Now we will have another episode of Who's Who before that, so I want you all to comment if I decide to get an autograph from John Glover, and I don't know that I will because I limit it to just a couple of people because it's very expensive, and there are other people I want to get more. But if I did get a something signed by John Glover, should I get him to sign like a Floronic Man comic book?
Oh
right?
My gosh.
Would that make, because the thing that we like to do, both Kelly and I like to do, is hand the person something that they're not expecting to ask to be signed, because it always sparks a conversation. Now, we don't always follow that. When we met William Shatner, we got him, I handed him Star Trek IV, but a lot of times we go for like an off-brand title and it just makes the person look up and like, oh, wow, look at this thing, you know, because they always are expecting the same thing. I don't think John Glover is expecting to be handed a Plant Master/Floronic Man comic book. And so I wonder, should I do that? Would that be fun?
If you're going to do it, I would do this Who's Who entry right here.
That's what I'm thinking is get a print out of this and get him to sign it. Now, all you out there listening, please weigh in the comments and I will duly take those under consideration before I go to the show.
Now, I'm going to tell you what you're going to get in some of the comments, too, is that John Glover played Jason Woodrow. He also played Lex Luthor's dad.
Of course, yes.
He also played Savannah's dad. So he is all over the DC universe as far as, I mean, he's like Ryan Reynolds of the DC universe, you know, starred in so many, he played so many different roles. It's crazy. So Jason Woodruff shows up there. Batman Robin, absolutely good call. Apparently, there was a villain that was based on the plant. It wasn't Plant Master exactly, but based on the Plant Master in Superman and Aquaman, Our Adventure, supposedly. I can't confirm that myself. Well, I mean, they, again, wasn't Jason Woodruff, but it was based on Plant Master, supposedly. Whatever. No. More importantly.
No, it wasn't.
Shut up.
It was not.
More importantly, recently, in when DC had its own TV series of shows, there was a Swamp Thing TV show, and Jason Woodruff was in there, and he was creepy as hell. And they did the anatomy lesson, and he was the one that did it. It was really powerful. And then, of course, he's appeared in some animated films as well, so he's really... Again, Millennium did great things for him. So, wow. All right.
Okay.
Up next. Oh, you know what haven't done in a long time, Rob?
What?
We haven't had the randomizer noise in like 6 inches.
Oh, no. Okay, well, one last thing I will say about John Glover.
Yeah.
If I don't do something from his comic book past, he has one line in Annie Hall, the masterpiece, Annie Hall, which I still quote to this day. So okay. Maybe I'll do Annie Hall just because he has the one line. Okay, that's enough about John Glover.
All right.
So anyway, yes. So next up is the Ghost Patrol. Of course, they became a household name after Millennium, but their first appearance was in Flash Comics.
It's going to be our catchphrase from now on.
I love that sentence so much. Flash Comics number. You know what it reminds me of? Hold on.
We talk about the Ghost Patrol?
No, we don't need to do that. That line. The Millennium made him a household name. Just reminds me of the days when you and I would podcast regularly and you would tell me that you would have arguments on the playground about how Darkseid was pronounced.
True. That is true.
And right. Exactly. And I'm like, what Norman Rockwell world did you grow up in that A, you had enough friends that A, also read comics enough that they would argue about such things? If I ever mentioned that I read a comic book in grade school, I would have been beaten up. And here you are having arguments about how to pronounce a member of Jack Kirby's Fourth World.
Well, it was middle school, not elementary school, but I was bullied.
Same goes for middle school.
Okay, I know. Probably worse in middle school. But anyway, I was bullied into reading comics. Never forget that. I didn't choose the comic life. The comic life chose me.
I can't wrap my head around that. I just can't. That's the same world that Millennium made people a household name. Okay.
I want to talk about Ghost Patrol. I have something important to say.
All right. The Ghost Patrol. They first appeared in Flash Comics number 29. They are three members of the French Foreign Legion, Fred, Pedro, and Sam, who end up coming back from the grave and realize they've been given a second chance. So they decide to fight Nazis during World War II. That is the basic premise of this strip. And now this thing is drawn by Luke McDonnell and Carl Kiesel. Since this, we covered this entry in Who's Who number, whatever it was, number nine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good. Number nine. I can say I have gone back and read some Ghost Patrol stories.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. I went to some of the darker corners of the internet and found some old issues of Flash Comics and actually read some Ghost Patrol stories. Now, as you and I have discussed, my tolerance for Golden Age stories is a lot greater than yours,
yeah.
Right? I think that's a fair thing. That's not even a knock. It's just a true statement. Even my high level of tolerance, I was like, okay, I think this listing makes them look a lot cooler than they kind of were.
Really?
The stories are impossibly wordy. Like, just there's panels where like there's a tiny head and there's just a balloon as one of them is just yammering on and on and on. And then the other thing is like, and again, you can't judge these things by 40 years later. It's not fair. But in these stories, all the Nazis are like comically inept bunglers. And of course, you know, back then they all superheroes were taking on Nazis. So you had different takes on the Nazis, but I just, in the cold light of day, it just looks weird to see Nazis being like, God in Himmel, you know, and they're just like clowns And you're like, yeah, but they're still Nazis. You know, like they're still really evil. So I read about 4 Ghost Patrol stories. And after that, I was like, yeah, I think I'm peacing out here. That said, I'm glad they got a listing. They look really cool. It's drawn by McDonald and Kiesel. I think they look really sharp. And it's the kind of thing where I would have been happy to see them reappear, and maybe they did. I'm glad they got a listing. Their logo, like the skull and the red thing, looks really cool. So McDonald and Kiesel did a great listing, probably even a little better than they kind of deserve.
Well, I want to point out, because we're going to say some different things about Luke McDonald in a minute, I think.
Yes.
This looks spectacular. This is inspiring. I want to see more of these adventures, maybe not the ones Rob read, but, you know, because you get them in the foreground and they're in their outfits. And I don't know if that's based on a French Foreign Legion outfit or just looks a badass pop collar. I don't know, but they look great. Mm-hmm. And then the heads in the background look really sharp. Like, really, like, each one of those guys looks different. And they're in surprint, and that's not necessarily easy to do. And yet, each guy looks individual. I like them, you know, crawling through. You can see their legs ghosting through the ground or in the cemetery. It just looks sharp, right? And I had to look it up because there's not a lot of information out there about these guys. They had over 75 appearances, which blew my mind. They went all the way from 1942 to 1949. And by the way, I'm going to give a shout out to the website where I found out this information, because again, I was struggling to find information. So thank you to some obscure website I've never heard of before called Siskoid's Blog of Geekery. So thank you to that strange, weird, weird little man. Here is what I have been waiting to say, and you wouldn't shut up for. Okay. This is what I'm so excited about. Is Rob, we have found it. We have found quite possibly the only entry in all of the original Who's Who where these characters have not been capitalized in movies, cartoons, nothing.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. They've appeared in some background panels in Shadow Pack, the comic. They had an issue of Scooby-Doo Team-Up, but that's still a comic book. No movies, no animated series, no cartoons, nothing. This is what I think James Gunn's going to build his comic, you know, his movie empire on. This will be the cornerstone, because he can like, here's something that hasn't been tapped yet. And so everyone out here, I want you to tweet to James Gunn and say, here is untapped potential right here. So there we go.
I mean, it's a neat idea, right?
Yeah, three
war buddies that are now ghosts, and they take on. Now, it's funny. You mentioned that they ran all the way till 1949. I didn't read the later stories. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of wondering, what did they do after World War II ended?
Well, the last paragraph actually addressed that. Because after the war, the Ghost Patrol acted as crime fighters. So,
I know that. No, I read that. But I'm just like wondered, like, crime fighters, like, were they fighting Nazis still? Like, Nazi, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think the implication is, like, bank robbers, I think is what they're saying.
Okay, maybe so. Kind of all right, I didn't read it. So, yeah, you could see why that it's, like, some characters need to be in their era. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks need to be fighting World War II, and outside of World War II, they just kind of don't work the same way. And so my God, they ran all the way to 49. They ran for 4 years after World War II. Uh-huh. So, you know, okay.
So I find it interesting that they were in Who's Who at all, I guess because of the how many issues they did, and the fact that they premiered in Flash means that, like, when Peter Sanderson read all this stuff, remember, Peter Sanderson read every DC comic and then documented it, right? The very fact that they were in Flash comics might have got them more attention than being in Police comics or something like
sure,
that.
Sure, yes.
So
yes.
Because they hadn't appeared. So again, they stop in 1949, and then in 1971, which is 14 years before this – they had a reprint in a World's Finest comic. I mean, they were not around. It's not like they even had a DC Comics Presents appearance. They got nothing. And so it's interesting that they made it here at all. So again, it's either a favorite character or just the very fact of being in the Flash brought them, you know, a little more attention, I think.
I mentioned this on a comment, I think, on Batman Family Reunion, where DC missed a real trick in not turning one of their mystery titles into mm-hmm. back when they were doing the dollar comics, turning one of their mystery books, which all had kind of the same content, you know what I mean? Like House of Mystery, Unexpected, sure. House of Secret, they're all kind of all the same thing, into like all of their supernatural superheroes into one book. Like, I think that might have been like, you know, like a dollar comic with Phantom Stranger, the Black Orchid, Swamp Thing, maybe, you know, like Bone of Frankenstein, yeah. And then Ghost Patrol. Like, you have a whole universe of horror adjacent superheroes, and that could have kind of gotten you like, oh, we got some horror and some superheroes, and we're going to place to use all these characters. I you know, like they look cool. Like I said, I only read the first four and I was not thrilled, but maybe I should go on and read more. Maybe they got better. I don't know.
Yeah, well, again, you can check Cisco's blog of Geekery for more information on that. Really, he's done the research for us. So, all right, up next, thank you, Randomizer. You gave us Helix by Todd McFarlane and Greg. All right, get it out of your system. Just get all the oofs out of your system right now.
All right, just there. What the hell is this?
Okay, so Helix, drawn by Todd McFarlane and Greg Thiekson. So these characters, you know, again, Todd McFarlane artwork. So early in his career, Thiekson, which is interesting. Usually I think of him as a Kirby anchor. So kind of an interesting combination. You've got the characters here. You've got Mr. Bones, who is a man who has invisible skin so you can see his bones. And he has a cyanide touch here. He's wearing basically the costume of the Black Terror. Then you have Dow Jones, who's a woman in a very
revealing.
Yeah, well, revealing and
form-fitting.
Yes, an outfit from the Orient. Let's put it that way. I'm trying
like
to
a dragon out, lady kind of.
Yes, thing. I'm trying to figure out how to say that. Thank you. Yeah, she's got sort of the stereotypical dragon lady outfit. You know, the green form-fitting bodysuit with the dragon on it, and the sash, and the gloves, and all that. You know, a lot of exposed skin and things like that. Then you've got Penny Dreadful, which is a girl in a white leotard, big boots, and a giant penny on her chest. You've got a little tiny girl called Baby Boom, who is like a toddler, maybe a 2 or 3 year old toddler in a little girl outfit carrying a lollipop and has glasses on. Then you've got Arak. Yeah, just like you think, like Arak Son of Thunder, but it's not. It's Arak the Windwalker or whatever his name is. And then you've got Critter, which is basically an anthropomorphic dog with glasses and a tie. So let's just put it on the table where it is. You know, first of all, it's McFarlane, early art. So I think the art is nice, but the characters are just freaking ridiculous. Like, I just think they are. So when you say that these characters were co-created by Roy Thomas, because they were, genuinely, compare this to something like Wolverine and go, no, this is what Roy creates, not Wolverine. But anyway, I had to get that out.
Okay.
You get the little heads in the corners too. Or I'm going to talk about the history in a minute. Let's just get the art discussion out of the way, because I know you hate Topping from.
I actually think this is pretty good. I think Greg Thiekson reins in some of McFarlane's worst excesses. He's still got that ridiculous cape that just looks just stupid. This is half a perfectly fine villain team. Mr. Bones looks cool. Dow Jones, looks cool. Arak, fine. Penny Dreadful, cool. But then you just see Baby Boom and Critter, and you're like, the fact that these are villains makes Infinity Inc., their opposing force, makes them look lame. Because you're like, really? You're taking on a dog wearing glasses and wearing a tie. What are we doing here?
Okay, but keep in mind, I put Penny Dreadful in the dumb category too. She's got a giant Lincoln penny on her chest.
But I mean, at least it's
all the names are like Penny Dreadful is a play on words, you know, Dow Jones is gotta be a play. It's just corny. So the idea here is that this evil gynecologist experimented on six. I know this. I can't believe I just said those words together. Experimented on six pregnant women. His name was Dr. Love, by the way. And all these six babies were born on the same night. And he kidnapped them all, locked them away, and raises them basically on pop culture, TV, books, radio. So this is what happens, kids, when you let your kids have Twitter too much. Dr. Love dies. And then they form this super group and they have take these ridiculous names. And they decide to take up kidnapping and extortion. Now, Arak, I want to talk about that for a second. So at first I saw that and I was like, huh, like Arak, Son of Thunder? And then I put it together. Roy Thomas created Arak, Son of Thunder.
Yes, he did.
So here, Arak, is it Windwalker? It's something.
Yeah, the Windwalker.
Yeah, Windwalker.
Arak the Windwalker.
He's a legacy character of the original Arak, supposedly, is how that works. Now, and again, I'm sorry if you're an Infinity Inc. fan at home. And I know you people are out there, and I have lots of mad respect for you. I just think this team is stupid. Mr. Bones is the only character worth a damn here, as far as I'm considered. And even at this point in his career, he's not that interesting. It isn't until you put him in a business suit and you put him in charge of the Department of Extraordinary Operations or whatever it is, the DEO, that he becomes an interesting character to me. Because he actually ends up joining the Infinity Inc., Mr. Bones does, and he accidentally kills Skyman, who's the old Star-Spangled Kid. He killed Sylvester Pemberton, which is kind of like, what? And I was reading online that apparently in the letters page for Infinity Inc., they did, I guess, quote unquote, announce that the next ongoing series was going to be Helix. Really?
Wow.
Okay. And then if you look at the character of Dow Jones, and then you remember JSA by Geoff Johns, she is very, very similar looking. If you just gave her red hair and made her, you know, Caucasian, she looks a lot like Roulette, who is the gambler's granddaughter, a very important character in the JSA world there. So I wonder if they just like said, well, we like the look of that character, but they're all stupid, so we're just going to make our own version of her, I think, maybe. I don't know. I'm not being very kind. So that's that.
It's just get rid of those two to me. Just get rid of the dog and the baby, mm-hmm. and you might have something. But they just, the minute, yeah.
So they premiered in Infinity Inc. number 17, which is just at this point 4 months ago. So this is a really fresh entry. You know, they must have just barely squeezed this in alphabetically because, again, only 4 months ago they've been introduced. So that means Who's Who was probably already laid out at that point, right? Because, I mean, they laid out all 24 issues, I assume, in some shape or fashion. And then, you know, Roy's like, hey, can you add this H character in? I don't know. So believe it or not, you know, we said Ghost Patrol's never made it into anything else. Well, Helix kind of did. There was a variation on Helix, not these characters by any stretch, but like a Helix, I don't think it was Helix Corporation or something. There was something echoing this in the Stargirl TV series based on Helix.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've had enough of them. Can we move on?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Up next is Jennifer Morgan from the Warlord series, drawn here by Dan Jurgens and Mike DiCarlo. So you've got her in the foreground in a very sexy green, you know, magical magician witch kind of outfit. So it's got like the sleeves are sort of like, I don't know, they hang down like Banshee's sleeves, like she could catch the wind, I guess. Deep plunging neckline, you know, lots of legs showing and loincloth dangling down and a skull kind of hanging from her belt and green boots. She looks great. She looks very sexy. She looks kind of like Clea because she's got like white hair and she's casting a spell. And she's got this pot, like a boiling cauldron, and really nicely done by Dan Jurgens and Mike DiCarlo. You can see the motion of the smoke coming off the cauldron because it's like swirling as it goes into her spell, which looks really nice. Then in the surprint, you've got a beautiful picture of her face. She looks kind of hard-edged, kind of angry there. And in the background, you see like maybe a volcano, and you see her and her dad standing there. So what do you think of the art before we go any further?
It's a great piece. I have to thank you for taking the hit on this one because I have zero to say about this character. I mean, no offense. It's just, and again, no offense to Mike Grell, who I actually interviewed once and was very nice. I think out of the 125 issues that Warlord ran, I think I read four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I played with the Warlord action figures from Remco more than I ever read the comic book. So I just don't know that. I mean, it's Warlord's daughter, Travis Morgan's daughter, which I did not know until I got to this entry. So it's perfectly fine, but I just have nothing to say about it because I just don't know the character at all. And all the stuff they're referring to, I don't know what they're talking about. So it's just like, okay, I don't know what this is next, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. No, I get that. And I've only read a few issues of Warlord myself. I bought the whole damn series. And it was like in my to read pile and I got through a few of them. I'm like, well, this is fun. And then I got distracted by something shiny. So I want to get back to it. And I've read a couple issues with her here and there. So a couple different things visually about it that I do wonder. So she's got this belt hanging down, right? And it's got a skull with these giant tusks on it. And folks, I want to know who decided in popular culture that hanging a giant scary skull over your nether regions specifically was like a good idea. Is that like some sort of celibacy tool? Like,
yes, like, the hey, scariest chastity belt in history. Although, right, we'll say, compared to the other Warlord characters, this outfit is rather demure.
So I thought about that. So it's Travis Morgan's daughter. And I'm thinking, like, if I was out, you know, in this area and my daughter showed up just like this, I'd be like, no, you go back in the castle right now and change. You are not going outside in that. But you make a good point. She does have a lot more clothes on than most of the women in Skartaris. So that's fair.
Florida and Skartaris have a lot in common.
Hey, you're welcome. It's a great place to live. reading her origin, yeah, she is the daughter of Travis Morgan. So what happened is, you know, she was about 8 years old when Travis's wife died tragically. So Travis is left with this 8-year-old kid and like he doesn't know what to do. So and he doesn't want her living on a military basis. So he sends her to live with her aunt. And so then 2 years after that, his plane goes down in Skartaris. So the world thinks he's dead. So here she is, this little kid, 8 years old, she loses her mom. Her mom, as far as she knows, at age 10, she's lost her dad, right? And so as she becomes an adult, she hears that he's resurfaced. He popped back up in the man's world for a while there and then went back to Skartaris. So she's like, what the hell? My dad's alive. So she goes on an expedition to find him. Now, the only thing I have trouble with here is a little bit of the math, is that she dies. I'm sorry. He quote unquote dies when she's 10 years old. Right. And then when she's an adult, she goes and finds him in Skartaris. Well, that's, you know, this is on issue 38 or whatever of the series. So like, how much time passed there? Like, if she was 10 and now she's a full grown woman, was he there for 8 to 10 years before, or is it just like some sort of weird time dilation when you go to Skartaris? I don't know, but it is that old trope where like they never mentioned her. Like Travis never mentioned he had a daughter until the issues where she shows up. There's that kind of, you know, thing like, oh yeah, my daughter, sort of thing. Anyway, so she shows up, she's reunited with her dad, and then he convinces her to go back to man's world, to our world. Unfortunately, on her way home, she gets shipwrecked. And she's captured by Deimos, who you know because you probably had the Remco figure, the bad guy. And he wipes her mind. And then later on, this evil sorceress trains Jennifer in magic. And Jennifer, you know, it's like when we last met, I was a student. Now I'm the master. That sort of thing. So Jen outdoes the evil sorceress and defeats her. And now she is supreme sorceress of Skartaris. So she helps her dad from time to time in adventures. At this point, again, well, she was introduced in Warlord 38. At this point, Warlord 101 is on the shelf. So she's been around for about, you know, 40 or no 60 issues or so at this point. So if you want more on her, you could check out the Warlord Worlds podcast with our friends Darren and Ruth Sutherland. So, and she appeared in Justice League Unlimited, I'm pretty sure. I think it was. I think that's right.
Wow.
Chris would have to correct me there. Or maybe it's just Justice League. Either way, I'm pretty sure they were in some of those. Or maybe I'm thinking of Batman Brave and the Bold. Oh, hell, I don't know. She's been in some damn cartoon. So, all right. All right. Next, Rob, this is a lot to talk about, this next one.
The big one. Justice League of America. It, of course, gets a 2-page spread. It's drawn by Luke McDonnell and Bill Ray. Once again, Bill Ray coming in as inker. And it features a shot of the entire team in kind of both its eras, the classic era, plus the new Detroit League, plus Snapper Carr, who absolutely does not deserve to be here. When professional football teams take, you know, photos of their team, do they let the water boy in on the photo? No, they do not, especially if the water boy had betrayed the team.
God.
I hate Snapper Carr. But anyway, I am of two minds of this piece. First of all, let's talk about the artwork. I am of two minds of this piece. One, Luke McDonald deserved to get this gig because he was the current artist on the book. And Who's Who was designed to be a sales tool as much as an informational tool. It was designed to be a sales tool. And you want to put the current teams probably doing the listing. So you can say, hey, do you like this? Well, you can get the book every month. That said, and I like Luke McDonald as an artist. I praised him just a couple entries ago on Ghost Patrol. I never thought he was a good fit for Justice League. He's too cartoony, too idiosyncratic. Although Mike Sienkowski did the book in the beginning, it's very idiosyncratic. But to me, Luke McDonald was never a good fit for Justice League. So considering this is the preeminent team of the DC universe, I wish they had gotten Dick Giordano. They were never going to get Neil Adams. But just somebody a little more iconic DCU art style to do this listing. But, you know, I understand Luke McDonald was the current artist of the book.
Well, and that got me down. I went down. I'm 100% co-signed everything you said, although probably even a little more aggressive. Honestly, this is just bad, like in my opinion. Like Wonder Woman looks so strange. Superman looks decent. Batman looks decent, but not good enough. Right. This is not the premier team of the DC universe. And really, truthfully, they weren't the premier team at this point because Teen Titans and Legion of Superheroes. Yeah, Teen Titans and Legion of Superheroes were selling much better than them. So I started really playing like a bigger game in my head of saying, okay, let's redo all this. Not take away Justice League Detroit because I still respect that team. Let's take away the artist. Like, you know, leave Chuck Patton on the book, right? Or something like that. Chuck Patton had drawn this entry. It would look gorgeous. But then I started thinking, okay, who, like DC, I think, has a responsibility to the Justice League book to always make sure there's at least a good artist on there. And again, Luke McDonald, we praise Ghost Patrol. I love him on Suicide Squad. Not here. So I started thinking, who could have they put on the book? And actually, DC's kind of screwed in 1985, right? Because like George Perez is tied up doing Crisis, all right? And if he's not doing that, he's probably going to do Teen Titans, right? One or the other. Because Eduardo Barreto is over there doing Teen Titans after George left. Outsiders has got Jim Aparo. Aquaman's got Craig Hamilton, but he can't turn out a monthly book. Booster Gold's got Dan Jurgens, which he's not going to walk away from because that's his baby. Beyond that, honestly, DC doesn't have a lot of big hitters in art at this point. I mean, they're still using, at this point, I looked at like comics literally on the shelf the same month as issue number 12 of Who's Who. They're still putting out comics drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger, by Don Heck, by Kurt Swan, all good quality draftsmen, but not hot artists for 1985. Meanwhile, you look across the street, or was it $6.50 cab ride up the road to Marvel, and they've got John Romita Jr., they've got John Byrne, they've got David Mazzucchelli, they've got Mike Zeck, Walt Simonson, Rick Butler, Bill Sienkiewicz. They've got a crap ton of amazing artistic talent over Marvel. DC just didn't have the bench at this point. So you wouldn't pull Eduardo Barreto off Teen Titans to give him Justice League because Teen Titans sells better. So I don't know what else they could have done unless they just went and found a talent that wasn't working for them at that point.
Yeah, I like I said, it all depends on your point of view of like, should the current artist of the book do the listing because this is a sales tool? And if you think that's the case, then yes, because that's who was doing the book.
Where I was going was like saying, take Luke McDonald off Justice League and replace him as an artist.
Right, okay, but that's a completely separate thing than what we're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. You're not talking about
it. All right, well, that's Justice League, not Who's Who. I'm saying, what choice does the editor of Who's Who have? Is it, do you get the guy who's drawing the current JLA book, or do you go for your go down the hall and get whatever position Giordano had and get him to do it? Because nobody, to me, there is nobody that represented DC more than Dick Giordano, and you get him to do the JLA, you know?
In classic Who's Who tradition, we're talking about two completely different things. I totally get what you're saying. Yes, Luke McDonald's the guy for this entry because he's drawing the book. I'm saying DC should have never had Luke McDonald drawing the book.
Okay, I agree with that.
And I was playing a hypothetical game of who else could they have gotten, and there's not a lot of choices. That's what I'm saying, is like the talent pool at DC was bare in 1985. And I think they would have heart. So I don't even know who they could have got. Besides, I'll put that out to you people at home. Who could they have got at the time that was already working for DC that would have made – again, you can't get George Perez. He's busy. He's doing Crisis. You know, who else do you get? The closest I got was Alan Davis because he had been doing some outsider stuff at that point. Maybe they could have used him because they haven't pissed him off with year two yet. That's still a couple years away. So maybe it could have been that. I don't know. I do think sort of funny with the headshots, because the headshots also look terrible, by the way. But I do think it's sort of funny because they did it alphabetically. Poor Superman. He's sandwiched between Snapper Carr and Steel and Vibe and Gypsy. You know, if I was like Superman, I'd be calling my agent going, seriously? What?
No. Not Gypsy, Vixen.
I'm sorry. Yes, Vixen. I apologize. Yeah, right.
But yeah, he's
a great... Which is a great character, but still, she's just like Detroit.
Superman's kind of stuck in the less visited corner of the headshots here. I do want to mention the text. There are it's six columns, and four of it is the origin.
So boring.
And funnily enough, chunks of it are just lifted from JLA number 200. Like literally just lifted from JLA. Now, of course, I'm not going to complain about that because, and I haven't had to say this in a long time, Justice League of America number 200 is the greatest piece of literature produced by Western civilization. So I have no problem. But like, there's a listing here where it mentions over the verdant plains of Africa.
Oh, that is, you're right.
That word is not a word you run into a whole lot. Verdant. And I learned that word from JLA number 200 because in the Green Lantern chapter, Jerry Conway uses that word. And I'm like, there's no way that wasn't lifted. That word is not a word that comes up very much. So chunks of it are just lifted. So then you get the origin and then you jump right to Snapper Carr, which and talk about betraying them, which is like, again.
I got a question about that. So that's actually, I own the issue. I must have read it. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I own some Justice Leagues I never read. I don't know. As a kid reading this entry, the Snapper Carr thing is given so much attention in here. To me, I was like, oh, that must have been a really big deal, that betrayal. So to this day, I don't know that I've ever read that story. Is that story like, is it? I mean, I know you hate him, but like, whatever happens in that issue, is it actually worth the mascot has been there since issue one or even before issue one? Is it worth him quitting the team over what happened?
Well, yes, yes, because he but his betrayal directly leads to them moving to the JLA satellite. So that, okay. I mean, he was the fulcrum of that. And he actually sort of gets conned by the Joker into betraying the Justice League. Now, much like Aquaman, Denny O'Neil kind of forgot that Snapper Carr was around, which good on you there, Denny. Snapper Carr had not been in the book in like, I don't know, like a year or 2 years.
Okay.
And then it was like, oh, then they brought him back as like, oh, you know, I was just the sidekick. Like he just became a mope after okay. that. And he returns to the book after 2 years to betray the Justice League. So you're like, wow, they got rid of him. Oh, he's back. Oh, he betrays his teammate. Like, what the hell? So they, right. So they jump right from the origin to that. Then they give Phantom Stranger like a whole paragraph, which
that's my next question.
A little odd. Like, really? It's not that big of a deal.
And also, then they just, that gave me an overinflated sense of importance as well as a kid reading right. this.
It's like, okay, yeah, you know. So then they talk about, oh, you know, other members came and went, and then they jump right to the Detroit. And then they say whether this new team will achieve the same heights as the old team, narrator, it doesn't. You know, it's so it's there's just, for a book that was one of the flagship titles of the DC universe for many years. More of its history should have been delineated as opposed to spending so much time on the origin. But mm-hmm. so,
and the current team got 1/6 of the space, which, you know, whether you like the Justice League Detroit team or not, if this is supposed to be a sales piece for the current book that's on the stands,
right.
you should have gave it some more.
Yeah.
And clearly the classic Justice League members are the central focus. And I think that's because by this point, they knew Justice League Detroit wasn't selling that well.
Yeah.
They were on issue 247 at this point, and 250, three issues from now, they make a big deal about the classic JLA coming back to visit with Detroit and Batman is going to join the team.
Yeah.
So at this point they kind of knew they were on shaky ground. So with that, I mean, I'm not going to tell you all the places you can find Justice League people. You know how to do that yourself. But I will mention here on the Firewater Podcast Network, we actually have three shows dedicated to the Justice League. We have the JLI podcast, which ends in August. We have the JLU cast, which deals with the animated series, which ends pretty soon. I don't know if it's this year or early next year, but it's ending soon as well. And For All Mankind, which just ended. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our Justice League content's going away, sadly, but we are picking monthly Justice Society content in its place. But lots of content you can enjoy here on the network all about the Justice League.
All right. So, next up is a half page entry, Little Cheese from Captain Carrot's Amazing Zoo Crew. I did not read this book after the first issue. I believe he's the only later member of the team, right? Because he first appears in Captain Carrot number 12.
So. I believe
so. He's the only one that is not there from the beginning and then joins later. And so, as you imagine, he is Little Cheese, a.k.a. the Micro Mouse. It's drawn by Scott Shaw, who they got to do all the Captain Carrot listings. And as you mentioned in previous episodes, Scott Shaw really brought it. Like, he really does a great – I mean, all these Captain Carrot pieces look like – presentation art for a Captain Carrot animated series that would never get produced, that never got produced, because they tell you everything you need to know. I do love his look without his costume. He's got like this kind of 70s flounced collar sort of thing going on. I mean, the book did come out in 1982, so I mean the 70s had just barely ended. But yeah, he's Little Cheese. I mean, what else is there really to say about it?
It's funny. I love how they make a point of saying, like, the moon in their universe really is made of cheese. And he eats a piece of cheese from the moon. And that's what gives him the ability to shrink, which is great.
Science.
Right. I mean, it's basically the same powers of the atom. He shrinks down the size of 6 inches and all that. And we've said it before, too. Like, I love the concepts of Captain Carrot. It doesn't always grab me when I try to read it, but I still appreciate it. It's fun, great Bronze Age concepts. I know a lot of our listeners love it based on the feedback. Holy moly. Now, at this point, this appeared in Who's Who number 13. And I should mention, I believe this is the first half-page entry we've done in Who's Who review. So yeah, so it is a half-page entry, so it is considered an entry unto itself. So we're not covering the rest of the page.
No, it counts as a separate entry, sure.
No, I know, but I'm explaining it for the people at home. We're not going to cover the whole page. Yeah. We're covering it by entry. So
yeah.
So right now on the shelves at the point this was published was Oz Wonderland number 3. So they were back, you know, in the DC publishing house being published with that miniseries. And we said it last time about Fastback. I'll say it again. It is still shocking to me that in no way, shape, or fashion has Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew been licensed in any significant way. Mm-hmm. Why they don't have their own animated short, something, I don't know. It just makes no sense.
They really should have had Little Cheese disappear into the jungle and do like a Sword of the Little Cheese thing. That would have been great.
Well, I think they did do kind of a parody of Identity, I think, of Identity Crisis, and I think Little Cheese died. Like, it was
Oh,
like,
dear God.
right,
Oh,
I think that was,
no.
I believe they
Oh,
did that.
no.
I can't, at one point it was advertised in Wizard Magazine, and we're all like, oh my gosh, it's an April Fool's Day joke, but maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but
Oh,
either
boy.
way. All right, up next is Mother Box. So this is from Who's Who, issue number 16, drawn by Jack Kirby and Mike Royer. So getting a little Kirby action here. So in the central image, in the center, and it's all put together kind of like a collage of frames or whatever. The center color image, you see three different mother boxes that look completely different. You know, one's red, one's gray, one's blue. They look completely different shapes, all that. Then in the surprint and the behind it, you've got Orion using the mother box to change him from his like savage apocalyptian version to his pretty new Genesis version. You've got, I'm pretty sure that's Ben Boxer, isn't it? On the bottom left-hand corner there, I think.
Yes.
Okay, Ben Boxer fixing like a mother box that's in his arm, and then you've got the Forever People on the right-hand side, where they're dealing with a mother box, and it's probably 10 times smarter than they are. So, the thing about Mother Box, and by the way, I kind of like the logo because it's just giant block letters. It just looks great. I like it as it is. But the frustrating thing to me about Mother Box is it pretty much gives you any power that you need for the story. That's the way this thing works. And it, interesting, as you read the entry here, it goes on basically saying that the Mother Box is alive and that it can feel pain, it can be killed, and it can be injured, and you can heal it through the power of love and belief. Now that is not something I remember ever seeing in an issue, or at least after the Jack Kirby days, about the Mother Boxes. I don't think that ever shows up any Justice League topics at all. But I love the Mother Box as a concept. I love it as a device. I love it when, Mr. Miracle's dealing, bing, and dealing with that. I absolutely love it. So what do you think of this piece?
It's fine. I'm kind of amazed that DC or some ancillary company has not made the mother box as a thing that you can buy,
No? Okay.
considering, and is this the second, is this the only, outside of Batman's utility belt, is this the only other object that they ever did at Who's Who? I can't
Well,
think of
like
another one.
Challenger's Mountain. I don't know if you
I
really count that. That's more like a
That's a
map.
location. That to me, that's a location. That's with the Batcave.
Didn't we have the Batmobile?
Was there a
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Batmobile?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we
Yeah.
got a snazzy, cool old
All
Batmobile,
right.
and
Okay.
I think we've had some objects,
Not
I
many
don't,
though, but not many. It says something about that the Mother Box gets a listing, considering these books were, long ago canceled. You know what I mean? It
there
says
were
something
no,
about.
that's a good point. There's no New Gods books on the shelves at this point. Absolutely zero, which is fascinating. So their first appearance is Rob's favorite comic, Forever People number one. He likes that even better than JLA number 200. And
How dare you?
if you want more on the Mother Box, you can check out, believe it or not, the Justice League movie. The giant blockbuster Justice League movie had Mother Boxes in it. They've been in animation. They've been everywhere. There's no point going into it. They've firmly cemented as being an integral part of the DC universe.
All right. Next up is Red Star from
Woohoo!
the original Teen Titans book, number 18. He is a Russian superhero. He would eventually change his name to Starfire. Or no, the other way around. He was Starfire, then he changed his name to Red Star. He was kind of, I mean, yes, he's a superhero, but of course, when during his creation, the Russia was the grand, global villain of the planet, and so there was a kind of like,
Thank God that's over.
that's God, and so the whole thing was like when he would meet the Teen Titans, it was sort of like. Do we trust this guy? That kind of thing, and then they would learn that everyone would learn sort of a lesson, like, oh, okay, he's a hero of his own people, and he can be trusted and stuff like that. The listing is drawn by Eduardo Barreto and inked by Eduardo Barreto, which means it's terrific. I think it looks great. I like his logo; it's kind of basic. The costume's a little, it's okay. It's a little on the dull side. I don't know about the short sleeves. I don't know how much they ever really work. But we see him
Wait,
lifting.
before you move on, you know
Yes.
who he looks like?
Who does he look like?
He looks like Booster Green.
Yes, he does. Yes, actually, he really does. Yeah. We see him in the background. We see him punching Robin. We see him lifting up a hunk of rock. We see Red Square in the background, and then of course we see him without his mask. And so it talks about then he would occasionally run into the Titans. And then again at the end it mentions that he changed his name to the more patriotic Red Star.
So a couple things in the surprint. One thing you didn't mention that and I never noticed it till getting ready for this episode. The surprint iconography in the back of like this black line moving away in the distance like the Star Wars crawl, and a giant star, and then sort of like a Wi-Fi symbol across the top of it, just like looks so cool. What a cool iconography. Like, it isn't necessarily saying Russian at all, but like when I look at it and go Russian, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll buy that. Sure. Yeah. It looks neat. A really great design element for the back. I love that.
Yeah. It's wonderfully designed. I mean, Eduardo Barreto was, you know, you mentioned the reason why he got to do Teen Titans after George Perez. He's a great artist.
Yep. And so, he changes his costume it's a few years, but a few years after this, all into like a red and yellow costume, and he becomes a lot beefier as well. And the red and yellow makes sense because the Russian or the Soviet Union flag and all that. But personally, I actually prefer the green costume. I like this look. I think it just looks cool. I always have. And it's sort of interesting. He was created by Len Wein, Marv Wolfman, and Bill Drout. Surprisingly, Roy Thomas had nothing to do with this creation, at least not yet. And when he was created, he was called Starfire, as you mentioned. And when he shows up, you know, I guess where I'm going is, I guess Marv Wolfman liked the name. Basically, you know, he creates one Starfire, like, oh, create another one, make her a hot chick this time. So he's created.
Oh, there already was a Starfire that was a hot chick. It was the Teen Titans. Oh, yeah. The second Starfire was a hot chick.
Good point. So it's interesting. He showed up in Teen Titans number 18, but then when he shows up in the new Teen Titans, it's also issue 18. Nice little synchronicity there. Huh. So his origin is that him and his father are exploring this famous 1908 meteor crash site in Russia, and turns out there's an alien ship there. And he goes in there and ends up getting these powers. And then when he meets up with the Titans, like you mentioned, and then in the Wolf and Perez area, there's this great story where – he has his fiance, and she comes to America, and she's been poisoned with radiation to try and kill the Americans, and he has to get involved. And you start to see a little bit of like cooperation between the Americans and the Russians. And eventually, long after this, he's actually assigned by the Russian government or Soviet government to be part of the Titans, because they have to keep an eye on Cyborg at that point. So he actually joins the team and becomes a member of the Titans. And I love him on the team. I absolutely love this character. Fun guy. And of course, just like everybody else, he's been in animation and stuff. He's been in the Teen Titans cartoon. Apparently, he was on Arrow and the Titans. I don't know that he had big roles in either, but he was there.
Wow.
So, yeah, absolutely cool. And I think that's all I've got on him. But I think he's a neat character, and I really dig the green costume. And yeah, I'm never going to stop saying Booster Green now.
All right. One last thing that I think is worth noting in his powers and weapons, it says, well, not as strong as, say, Superman. Red Star is able to lift heavy objects, yada, yada, yada. I like the looseness of that language. That's usually not the language of Huzu. Huzu is always very direct.
Yeah.
But I just kind of like, it's very like, well, not as strong as saying, I don't know, Superman? Like, it's very, very informal. They didn't do that in these listings. So. Okay. Yeah. Superman. Why not?
Sure. I'll just pick him.
Yeah. That's fine.
All right. On to TNT and Dan the Dynamite. So we've got a double entry here where you've got actually two different sets of personal data, which is kind of cool. But we're going to talk about this very specifically. We're going to tackle this a certain way, Rob. We're going to talk about the art. Then after we're done with that, we're going to talk about the entry. Okay. Mm-hmm. So first off, the art. So you've got in the foreground, first of all, I should say it's drawn and inked by Romeo Tengal. So you know it's beautiful. So in the foreground, you've got the logo TNT and Dynamite, Dan the Dynamite. Then you've got TNT, he's there with the green leotard and the blue accents and the blue cape with the letters TNT. And then you've got Dynamite, who is the opposite color scheme, which is great. I love the parallels there of the blue bodysuit with the green accents. And they look great. They're like, you know, action poses. And then in the surprint, you've got beautiful heads of both the guys, of both TNT and Dan the Dynamite. By the way, I should specifically say, if you're not familiar with them, it's, you know, it's the adult hero and his teen sidekick, and these are Golden Age characters. Then in the background, you've got them shaking hands, which is causing this atomic explosion and giving them powers. You get them punching out bad guys. So again, Romeo Tengal did this. It looks fantastic. Let's talk about how much we like the art, and I love the color scheme, and then I got a story to tell. So what do you think of the art?
I like the artwork. I think their costumes are kind of like, all right. I mean, it's like, I like that their colors are reversed. That's fun. Yeah. But I wish they had like some symbols or something. I don't know. They're just kind of relatively on the dull side. He's got the TNT on his chest, but it's like, all right.
It's like whatever. The 1942 or something.
It is, right. I mean, they first appeared in Star Spangled Comics number 7. So they've been around a really long time. I do find it interesting that they appeared in a particularly good issue of Super Friends, the Super Friends comic. And there is no mention of that in this listing. And
well,
so
we're not getting to the listing yet. We're getting to
I'm just saying there is no mention of the Super Friends. So once again, the Super Friends comic excluded from any sort of DC continuity.
Well, it does mess up, you know, as Roy Thomas, the co-creator of every character in this book, will tell you that that would mess up continuity because of what I'm going to tell you about in just a second when we get to the entry.
Yep.
But so here is the cool thing, though. I wanted to talk about the art first, folks. The original artwork for this entry is in the possession of one of the listeners of this show.
Mm-hmm.
It is so freaking cool. So Bruno Diaz, who is one of our Patreon supporters, and really, we appreciate his support, and he's been great sending us stuff, images and stuff. He loves doing custom figures. In fact, he won a yellow dot on a previous episode, and he did custom figures of TNT and Dynamite, Dan the Dynamite, and they look great. And, they look absolutely fantastic, these custom figures he did. And what he did was I love what he wrote. He said, he goes, I'm also attaching two pictures of my custom figures, one of which is done in the true Who's Who Bruno Diaz Yellow Dot Award winner fashion, because he's done the action figures and then he put them, you know, photoshopped them into the entry as well, as if the action figures are part of the entry. So it looks great. In fact, tell you what, Bruno, what the hell? I'll throw you another Yellow Dot Award for doing another awesome action figure thing. Well done.
I hope he has that on his LinkedIn page.
I bet he does. So he wrote us this letter. He says, over the past few years, I have bought a few sketches from Romeo Tengal. And by the way, if you don't follow Romeo Tengal on social media, you're a fool. You really should. He does amazing stuff. Anyway, I bought a few sketches from Romeo Tengal and messaged him a bit. Last year, I sent him a picture of the TNT and Dan the Dynamite custom figures that I made and asked if he could draw a sketch of those two characters because he did their entry in Who's Who. Also, he likes to go to IHOP, the International House of Pancakes. So I sent him a gift card for IHOP along with the payment. 2 weeks later, I got an envelope in the mail from him, and I opened it. It didn't look like his other sketches, so I was confused. It looked like he inked it, too. And I looked closer, and I saw pencil marks on it. I turned it over, and written on the back was, to Bruno, found this original artwork that was published by DC Comics in Who's Who. This treasure will now find a good home in you. Best, Romeo Tengal Sr., 2023. And thanks for the surprise IHOP gift card. He sent the original entry. So
stunning.
It's not the
stunning turn of events.
Now, if you know how Who's Who worked, they would draw the main image on one piece of paper, and then on vellum they would draw the serpent. So he's got the original one. So he's got the two figures and the circles. He doesn't have the inset serpent figures, but man, it is. In fact, it lets you really just focus on the character line work, and it's just gorgeous. I mean, Romeo did this thing beautifully. The pen marks, the width of the lines, how they are wider and then skinnier as you get to the points, is just stunning. In fact, Bruno says, he goes, I'm not going to lie, I teared up a little. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
What a wonderful guy. What a great story that is. Like, that's, yes. That's,
oh. Now, I want to emphasize, people at home, understand that Romeo is not sitting on a stack of free stuff to give you. So do not think if you send him an IHOP gift card, you're going to get free stuff from him. That is not the point of this story. Do not learn the wrong lesson here. The right lesson is that Romeo Tengal is an amazing guy. And this is such a cool entry. And wow, just so cool. That is so, so amazing. Oh, I love it. All right, now we get to talk about the entry. So this is where things diverge, okay? So as I mentioned, you get two sets of personal data. And here's what the interesting thing is, why your super friend story doesn't work. Because 4 months from now, when this issue's published, 4 months from now, Young All-Stars number one will be on the shelves. And TNT's going to die in 1942. So he couldn't be around for Super Friends, right? Unless it was a time travel issue.
Which it was not, no.
Okay. So, yeah. So obviously, you know, that's invalidated, so it can't happen. And it's sort of an interesting story what happens there. So TNT dies, and Dan the Dynamite's got to figure out what to do. You know, here's a teen sidekick without a mentor anymore, right? And so he ends up with the Young All-Stars and has a really great history there and with that team and is very successful with it. And by the way, the reason I mentioned the Stargirl Lost Children series in the beginning is because Dan the Dynamite is a supporting character. He starts the book as an old man, and by the end of the series, he's a young guy again as Dan the Dynamite. So it's pretty cool. So here's the history of these two characters. So TNT, the guy, Thomas Thomas. Oh, wow. His name's Thomas Thomas. Oh, TNT. Look at that. That's clever. Thomas and Thomas. Okay. So he was a chemistry teacher, and Dan Dunbar was his star pupil. And they were doing an experiment with positive and negative solutions, and it caused a reaction in them. So when they pressed their rings together, they become charged with atomic energy, which gives them super strength. It can shoot blasts and has electric punches, which is super cool. Now, I wish I could tell you everything I just told you was what the entry explains. That is not the case. Did you read the entry, Rob?
Yes.
Oh, boy. This thing is written very questionably. It reads like gay slash fiction. I mean, it really does. It talks about this high school teacher and his star student studying chemistry together late in the evenings at night, and how they're doing an experiment and casually, accidentally, their hands touched each other. I mean, it is really going deep here with the symbolism, right?
More innocent times.
Yeah, but not the way this writer wrote it. Because, yeah, it says their hands accidentally touched, which made them feel stronger. I mean, okay. And then they decided to keep this thing a secret. I mean, he's really coding this as gay storyline. Is it, whoever wrote this was intentional. There's no doubt in my mind. He's intentionally doing that. Now, there's a problem with that. I'm just saying he or she wrote this with that in mind as the subtext. So
it was a he. I think we could be pretty sure.
That's probably true.
It was okay. A he.
So going beyond that, it does talk about how their powers were going out of control. So I think by this point, Roy was already starting to hone in on that Dan the Dynamite was going to be a character in Young All-Stars. And it does leave me sort of wondering, you know, as he had to prepare for this Who's Who entry, and he's 4 months out from Young All-Stars, did preparing for this entry play a role in him picking this character to be in the Young All-Stars? Did he kind of, you know, like, oh, maybe I should do that. Like, maybe he hadn't decided what character he was going to pick yet. I don't know. But Dan the Dynamite goes on to a really interesting career, again, with the Young All-Stars. Then there's a series in the 90s or 2000s called Young Justice, which was the Young Justice League characters. And at that point, they go up against a group of geriatrics called Old Justice, where, like, these older sidekicks who don't want the kids to be out there anymore because it's dangerous. He was a member of that. Again, he's in the Lost Children. He becomes young again. Now he's, I believe, tied in with what they call the Young Justice Society. And without going into a lot of details, because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, if you haven't read the Elseworlds called Golden Age, he plays a very important role in there.
Yes, he does.
Go read it. It's damn good. And I don't want to spoil anything more than that. But so yeah, that's what I've got in this entry. What about you?
That was way more about these two characters than they deserve. I'm sorry. you should have focused on the Bruno Diaz part of it, and the rest of it is like, okay, fine. By the way, if you haven't read Golden Age, as Shag said, go read it. Then go listen to the episode of FW Presents that we did with Noah Tarnow.
Not with FW Presents. It was JSA Presents.
Oh, was it JSA Presents? Okay, JSA Presents. Go back and listen to that episode. By the way, it says here at the end, it is unclear what happened to TNT and Dan the Dynamite after 1943, now that their history has been changed in the Crisis on Infinite Earths. That does not necessarily preclude their appearance in Super Friends. It really doesn't. You have to kind of fudge it a little, but it really kind of doesn't. But again, we know Super Friends is not part of continuity.
That line probably got put in there to say that because of Crisis, Super Friends didn't happen. I bet that's why
probably.
It's there.
And one other thing, because we've gone on way too long about these two characters, this is one of the few entries I would say that the surprint features some sort of panel sequence where you kind of have things going in order where they touch hands, there goes the boom, and then we see them in their costumes beating up some guys. So there's a little bit of a loose continuity of one, two, three, there you go.
Yeah, it's a sequential storytelling.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, for more on them, we just mentioned you can listen to JSA Presents. Earth 2 Podcast is a great place for more, and I mentioned a whole bunch of comics you can read as well. So that is your 13 entries, folks, but now we are going to move on to Zoom's Who. So Zoom's Who, Zoom, you can always, I guess we should call it Zoom and Asamu's, you can always addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. So we're going to cover a single page split entry, and credit goes to both Zoom Yukinori and Asamu Yukinori. Zoom, that bastard, I mean, I love him. How many years has he been going and he's still putting out better crap than me?
That's what I'm saying. I think he's in a computer.
So Zoom actually wrote these entries. God knows when he found the time to do it. And Asamu has put the text in and laid it out and pulled together the art. So it is definitely a duo combination here. So we get two characters. We get Incognito and Itty, both two characters from the letter I that were missed from the original Who's Who. So I'll cover the first one, then Rob can cover the second one. So the first character is Incognito. It's got a really nice looking cool logo with kind of sketchy letters. In the front, you've got this silhouette of a man all in black because that's what he looked like. That's what Incognito looked like. And in the surprint, you've got Firestorm creeping up on this guy who's half his face is melting because Incognito was a shape changer. One of the things I got to say, nicely done to Asamu on here. You've got the silhouette, but it's grainy. It's all grainy, like newsprint. Like, you know, you can see where the white dots of the newsprint are kind of bleeding through, where the black didn't completely, you know, cover the newsprint paper. I love that casual effect. It looks really, really great. It looks realistic. So everything about this character is unknown. Unknown name, unknown marital status, everything. Other than he worked for the Assassination Bureau. His first appearance was in Fury of First Arm number 29. Basically, he is a shape-changing bad guy who's part of the Assassination Bureau, but really he's a double agent for this other guy named The Fix, and he's trying to kidnap the Mind Boggler to use her as a human weapon. Well, in the end, Firestorm ends up kidnapping all of them. He kidnaps Incognito and Fix and the Assassin Bureau 2000 committee. He takes it all down because, you know, Firestorm's a badass. And the sort of self-admission I will say here is I have almost no recollection of this guy at all. And I'm the Firestorm guy. I should know who this is, right? Even more embarrassingly, his first appearance is Fury of Firestorm number 29. The first two issues of Firestorm I ever bought on the same day were issue number 28 and issue 30. So he's all up in this stuff. And I got like I barely remember this guy existed. So didn't leave a lot of impression. Maybe he didn't deserve the Who's Who entry. I don't know. But he looks great. And so, by the way, the art here is by Rafael Kianen and Romeo Tengel. I should mention that. And what's happened is Osamu has compiled that art into a great looking piece. So what do you think of this half?
I mean, again, it's a great piece courtesy of Zoom and Isamu. Rafael Kianen, right? Great artist. There's no doubt about that. But I am sure that when he decided to design this character as simply a black silhouette, he's like, let me see if I can sneak this by the guys at DC, if I can get away with this, because I don't feel like designing anything. How about he's just a silhouette? And they're like, let me see if Jerry will let me. And it went through. And then he's like, yay, I don't have to draw this. And in fact, all I have to do is draw the body and the inker will fill it in dark. In ink. So good on you, Rafael Kayanan. You know, like
that is hilarious. Well, after drawing Firestorm's complicated costume, you know, give a guy a break.
Work smarter, not harder. You know, I mean, so I give him credit for that. But yeah, I mean, I outside of the list, I mean, look, you could make an argument that every Firestorm villain deserved a listing because there was a brief period where the Fury of Firestorm was like DC's second best selling book, right? Like right behind Teen Titans.
I don't know if it was second, but it was really high up there.
Very high up there. Yeah. It was a bestseller.
Specifically in the direct market. I don't know how well sold in the newsstands, but in the direct market, it was a huge seller.
Well, that's funny that they didn't do the thing that with Firestorm that they didn't do with the other books. Tales of Firestorm. Tales of the Fury of Firestorm. But but you could make the argument that since Firestorm was that popular, every villain deserved a listing. Because that, you know, so sure, why not?
It looks great. And I love the attention to detail here, man, for the Yukinori family, where the surprint is green. And so therefore, the words, art by Rafael Kanin and Romeo Tengel, and the box at the end of the text to let you know that's the end of the entry, are also green. I mean, that's the level of attention to detail. Just, yeah. So well done, guys. Yep. All right, what's the other half of the entry, Rob?
So the other half is Itty. And you may be wondering, what the hell is Itty? Well, if you read comics in DC Comics in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and sort of the 70s, early 70s, you were nothing in the DC universe if you didn't have an intergalactic imp to bedevil you every so often. Every single major DC character had one. Mr. Mxyzptlk, Batmite. You had Brody,
Quisp
from Aquaman, Mopey on Flash, even Martian Manhunter had one. I think it was called Zook.
Yes, he did.
And Green Lantern had a little starfish alien that hitched a ride on his shoulder, and he was a member of an alien race called the Ares. And and Green Lantern called him Itty, and he basically just sort of caused trouble for Green Lantern. Now, not very much. He didn't make that many appearances, but every so often he would appear and he would evolve into a higher life form, which resembled a giant gaseous humanoid and left Earth to search of its destiny among the stars. So it never figured into Green Lantern continuity that much. And it was when Green Lantern had a backup in Flash. It was one of Green Lantern's lower ebbs. But nevertheless, he is the intergalactic imp for the Green Lantern book.
So I had to look it up to see how long he was a sidekick. And near as I can tell, he was only really a sidekick for about 2.5 years is what looks like to me.
2.5 years.
It's still a long time. Yes. Yeah. I do love it. A great job here, Zoom, on the entry. Like base of operations, formerly Green Lantern's shoulder, now outer space. I love that. That's hilarious. And the image itself is really, really clever because you've got Itty in the foreground. It just looks like a starfish, right? But then you've got Hal as a serpent, but it's not just Hal as a serpent. It's Hal looking at his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
How clever is that?
The art by Mike Grell and Terry Austin, we should mention.
So that's what Zoom did, was he found, and I stumbled across this image, by the way, the other day, the actual comic image. So it's Hal looking at his shoulder. And so what Zoom has done is separated sort of the layers and put Itty up there and put Hal in the background. And it works so well. It's really, really cleverly done. It's nice. I don't have a lot to say about Itty himself. I love the entry more than I care about the character.
Yes. That's most of these. Is, you know, look, it's the artistry of Zoom and Izumu that's worth talking about than these incredibly obscure characters from the corners of the DC universe.
And I don't know if that Itty is a logo that ever appeared anywhere. If not, it should have. It looks so cool. The word Itty, it looks great.
I'm pretty sure Isamu took that from the Hostess ad that Itty had to himself in the mid-70s.
Okay, I don't know if that sentence was a joke or not. I still don't know. You need to tell me. Did he seriously have his own Hostess entry?
It's as plausible as Millennium making somebody a household name. So.
Well, it looks great. And again, I love the solid green. And again, you can see the white, you know, ink bleeding through, or the white paper bleeding through, like where the green didn't fully fill the space, like a real newsprint. Like, because when you look at these other scans, you're like, yeah, okay, the ink didn't fully fill it because the paper shows through. So, it's geniusly put together. So incredibly well done by Zoom and Isamu. I absolutely love this. Looks great.
I can't wait to see these in Zoom's Who number two, book two.
Right.
Coming soon.
It is being worked on right now, folks. You should follow Isamu on in Twitter because he's talking about the book. He's talking about pre-orders.
You can send in letters. You can send in a letter and get it printed, maybe.
So the letters page of Zoom's Who issue 2 has a spot for letters from issue number 1 where you can write and go, well, excuse me, you know, and the whatever character, you know, Satin Satan did not have that height. She was much shorter, you know, whatever. I don't care. Write in. And so they have some fun letters in there and someone's begging for them. So please, please do that.
My letter better get in there. Damn it. I am not going to relive my 1985 era. I need to get my letter printed in Zoom.
That is so funny. All right. So I ask you, as we always do, Rob, at the end of these entries, what are the best entries in this volume that we covered?
Well, okay.
If you don't say Helix, you're a damn liar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look,
Wow.
I'm not
being one of those sentences.
I'm not being intellectually honest, but I'm going to say Justice League is one of my favorites.
Oh,
just because it's Justice League. It's still Justice League.
Right. There's your evidence. Rob lied to your face. There it is. So I'm never doubt it.
Okay. All right. Put that aside. My favorites are Dawnstar. How many do we limit this to? Three, right?
I usually pick three or something.
Three. Yeah. Okay. The three best, I think, arguably are Dawnstar, Electrocutioner, and Ghost Patrol. I would say those are my three favorites.
Those are all good. I also picked Dawnstar, fantastic piece. I also picked Red Star. I think that's a great, by Eduardo Barreto. I think that's a great looking piece. And then my number one pick is Adam by Gil Kane. I just think that is a stunning as hell piece. I may be a little biased because I'm just totally riding the sword of the Adam high right now. Maybe I licked one of the frogs that he rides. I don't know. But I'm totally in love with that right now. So. All right. So, folks, again, thank you to Zoom. And so I'm going to remember later this month, we're going to cover another brand new Zoom's Who piece from Isamu Yukinori in the Justice League International flashback episode. That episode will appear on both the Who's Who feed and the Justice League International piece feed. And it is an amazing piece. Again, I can't talk about it yet, but it was something that was sorely missed in the loose leaf edition of Who's Who. And you're going to love it, folks. I can't wait. And for all the items we just talked about, you can find those over at the Fire and Water Podcast Network on our gallery post, and they will all be there. And holy crap, I just realized we have like 3 hours left of recording, so we got to do our feedback still. All right. So with that, let's go to a podcast promo break. What do you say, Rob?
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Oh, hi, Dr. Sterner.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing these days?
I'm good. Since you, cured me of my DC OCD, I've got so much more time on my hands. It's been for the best.
Well, personally and professionally, I'm quite proud of what we have achieved, but I have some bad news for you, Paul.
Oh? What?
There's something missing without your DC OCD there.
Oh.
I've even heard friends of yours been saying you're basic. A little boring. There's no there.
Oh, what should we do about it?
My God, I hate to have to say this, but we have to go bring it back somehow.
Whoa, shall we do some more sessions and I can use them to talk about DC events that we haven't covered, like Dark Crisis and Fear State, those sorts of things.
I think that might be for the best, Paul. Let's reconvene in 2024 for more sessions of DC OCD.
And that'll make me interesting?
We will see, Paul. We will see.
Are you tired of fanboy comics podcasts? Looking for a show that really appreciates the comic storytelling medium and how it works? A show that looks at comics from any genre and anywhere in the world, comparing the storytelling techniques of different creators in different comics cultures, with manga, newspaper strips, European comics, and more discussed alongside mainstream U.S. comics. A show that includes talks with well-known creators like James Robinson and Dan Jurgens, and with less famous creators that you really should know. And hey, we'll even critique your comic. If you're looking for that show, then you're looking for Deconstructing Comics, and it's right here at deconstructingcomics.com. Also available in iTunes and on Stitcher. This is Tim saying check out our show on Wednesdays. That's Deconstructing Comics.
All right, folks, now this is the part of the show where you get to contribute. It's called Who's Who, Hows, and Whys. And first up, we're going to talk about iTunes reviews. So as we say, please go out and give us some iTunes reviews. We have several, but you know, now that the show's back to a more regular schedule, we would love to have some more of those. Draw a little bit of attention to the book. And first up is Alan W. Wright from RobinHoodBoldOutlaw.com and the Straight Out of the Federation Blake 7 podcast. Alan was kind enough to leave us an iTunes review. And when you do that, folks, we will read the entire iTunes review on the air. He writes, great comic duo covering great comic books. Rob and Shag have great chemistry as they look at DC Comics' various attempts to outdo the Encyclopedia Britannica with profiles of DC's colorful characters and concepts. It's a fun and nostalgic look at the pop culture past. Well, thank you, Alan. We sincerely appreciate that. And folks, again, please consider going out to iTunes and leaving us a review. Won't cost you anything and just helps the show a little bit. All right, as we get into your feedback, remember, we are going to be pulling comments just from our website because they're – even just from our website, there's 27 pages of feedback, okay? So keep it coming, but just know that's where we're getting it from. So website, iTunes reviews, and emails. That's the place where we're not going to pull anything from social media other than reshares and tweets and stuff like that. It's just too much folks. But again, we thank you to everyone who contributes. And do keep sharing on social media. We will mention you at the end. First up is Hal. That's all I've got. His name is Hal. I kind of hope it's Hal Jordan, but I don't know. Anyway, he says, like you guys, maybe he's got a little starfish on his shoulder. Anyway, he says, like you guys, I don't read much of the new stuff except for the new Golden Age books, but I do keep up with some of the spoiler and review sites. Now, Rob, stepping out of it for a second, you remember last time we covered a lot of new Who's Who entries that were featured in some of the DC books recently. So that's what he's referring to. One of the characters was called The Signal, and we had no idea who this was.
No, we did not.
He says, the Signal character you mentioned at the beginning of the show during the new Who's Who pages we covered is perhaps better known as the Batman character Duke Thomas. So there we go. All right. Well, thank you, Hal.
I'm further away from it than I was.
I wasn't going to say that, but hey, Hal, we appreciate you trying to educate us stuffy old men. So thank you.
There you go. Buffalo DeLorean, great, one of the great handles of any Who's Who commenter, says, mentions a bunch of things, and then just a couple of them here. It says, Ragman being Jewish is so built into this version of the character that I know. I had no idea that it wasn't part of the original concept. I suppose the name Rory Regan does sound pretty Irish, though. Irish Jewish. I read an interesting article on Thriller that really painted it in a glorious mess light. Apparently, it was very much the idea of Robert Loren Fleming, who only wrote 7 of its 12 issues. Yeah, if you read that book, it definitely reads of like DC sort of like rolling its eyes going, all right, God, all right, well, here you go. Just do it. That kind of thing.
He says, we got to finish it up for the subscription people.
Yeah. I can't disagree with the concern of overcrowding the new Superman movie, but I'm really looking forward to Anthony Carrigan as Metamorpho. He's wonderfully funny in the show Barry, and he's made some interesting comments and interviews about relating to the character because of his alopecia. In the same vein as what Shag said, I've seen speculation that all the other heroes will be there to highlight how even a world or theater-going audience with so many other superheroes still needs Superman specifically, which sounds a little too doomsday clocky for me. We'll see, Buffalo. I will say this about the movie that I think since the last episode that we did, they have changed the name of the movie from Superman Legacy to simply Superman, which I think is a step in the right direction. I thought Superman Legacy was an awful title. And so I'm glad that they are, that they dropped the legacy part. So I think that's at least a step in the right direction.
Well, I mean, having seen the Suicide Squad, having seen Blue Beetle, I have confidence that this has every chance of being a good movie. So I'm not willing to write it off yet.
I'm not writing it off. I'm saying that's just a bad title. It's just a bad title. I think that title keeps people away. Superman Legacy is like, well, how many did I have to see the other Superman movies? That's the last thing you want to do if you're trying to restart the DC cinematic universe.
Oh, wait, hold on. Breaking news. Wow. Okay. I'm on Twitter right now and I see that James Gunn has just updated it, Rob. Seriously, no. It says here the movie has now been retitled Superman and the Ghost Patrol. So look at that. Making crap happen. That is the Fire and Water Network right there.
Before the show's even published, we've just got it up. Right, guys.
There it is. Look at us. Woo. All right.
That's really exciting. Isamu Yukinori, of course, we just mentioned, says the Cheetah 2 entry is indeed great. While Deborah Domain had been the Cheetah for, quote, only 6 years, she had only been in a few stories. Her origin in Wonder Woman 274, 275, the Secret Society three-parter, JLA 195, 197, there it is again. One more Wonder Woman story, 323, which featured three other Wonder Woman villains, and the all-villains issue in Crisis number 9. And it was only in the first story where the Cheetah played the primary role in the story. Such a waste.
So crazy. Again, I don't know whether Who's Who just messed me up or promotional artwork maybe or whatever. But I mean, in my head, that version of Cheetah is supposed to be Cheetah to me.
Yep.
And yet she had so few appearances. Someone added that Colleen Duran, because we talked about her, was an amazing artist. And he says, I discovered her work in her adaptations of Neil Gaiman's short stories. The latest, Chivalry, is fantastic. And he says, my mom has been reading A Distant Soil when she was a teenager. And she did amazing work on this crypto piece. Yeah, she absolutely did. It was absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And then he says, the Sportsmaster is very badass in the Young Justice cartoon series. The first comic I read featuring him was another DC Superstars, issue number 10, where he manipulates Earth 1 superheroes and supervillains to play a game of baseball to try and dissuade the Huntress from giving up villainy and becoming a costume hero. Spoiler, it didn't work. And when he says Huntress, he's talking about the Golden Age villain, his girlfriend. And he says, of course, Huntress is... Oh, Who's Who entry does not acknowledge that bonkers story. Oh, it should have. Forcing heroes to play baseball is just amazing.
Before I get to his next comment, I want to say that he did not write the word badass. He actually wrote bad at symbol SS, like on Twitter, you know, adding somebody SS. And looking at, first of all, I think it's very cute. I also think when I see that, I'm like, someone should start an All-Star Squadron Twitter handle and just call it SS. That way, when you write to them, it's ASS. I think that would be really clever.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea, Rob, for someone to start a handle where you're about a team fighting the Nazis and their handle's SS. That's a great idea.
Thank you. I choose to take that literally. He says, speaking of bonkers, that retroactive editing of the Sunburst entry. Wow. I'm surprised he didn't rewrite the character's first appearance as the totally true but unpublished adventures of Red Sun number 45. What's interesting to me is that later Who's Who entries featuring Terra Man and Vartox would still retain their pre-crisis histories. This is likely due to the chronal after effects of these characters appearing in the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show, and absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the post-crisis versions of the characters hadn't been figured out yet.
I love that he worked in a chance to pimp his dad's show, Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show. That's awesome.
Fantastic. Kevin from New Orleans says, after listening to this episode, I realized that from the past 10 to 15 years, we have gotten every member of the Legion of Doom in live action except for Giganta. And don't y'all think it's weird that he wasn't put in the Justice League comic when the cartoon came out? Also, do y'all have any knowledge of how Hanna-Barbera came up with the lineup for the team? Well, the minute you ask a question, Isamu shows up with the answer. Again, apple and tree and all that. He says, do Giganta's appearances in the 1978 Legends of the Superheroes specials played by Alicia Brevard count?
I'd say absolutely. Yeah, that's live action right there.
Yeah.
We count it for Mordrew, right?
Yeah. Regarding the Legion of Doom, Alex Toth created a presentation painting of the League of Evil for what was originally called the Battle of the Super Friends, later changed to Challenge, since Battle was deemed too strong a title by ABC. According to page 235 of Toth by Design, the original lineup was suggested by fellow Hanna-Barbera artist and animator Darryl McNeil and was composed of then-leader and Captain Marvel arch-foe Dr. Savannah, Sinestro, Captain Cold, the Joker, Beauteous Savannah, The Penguin, Abracadabra, Poison Ivy, Heat Wave, King Call, Grodd, Mr. Adam, and the Cheetah, plus Mr. Freeze, not pictured. The original Legion of Doom called the League of Evil. And there he shows the piece in the comment. And you see this fantastic drawing of the, you know, nascent Legion of Doom, but featuring very, very different characters.
I love how they all have little partitioned seats.
It's great. It's the body language. Toth was so good at body language. Like, I love the sort of pissy pose that Sinestra's in with his legs crossed. Like, he's kind of like, I should be leading this team. It looks great. McNeil wrote, that year, 78, Hanna-Barbera had picked up the rights to Captain Marvel for their live-action Legends of the Superheroes pilots and intended to make him a member of the Super Friends as well. Rival studio Filmation, however, held the animation rights to the Big Red Cheese, and even though both studios shared the animation rights to Batman and Robin, also held the rights to most of the Caped Crusaders Rogues Gallery. So without access to these characters, Dr. Savannah, Beautia, Penguin, Joker, Poison Ivy, King Cole, Mr. Adam, Catwoman, and proposed Batvillain Mr. Freeze were dropped from the Legion lineup, replaced with lesser, but better for story purposes, it turned out, Bat Fiends, Riddler, and Scarecrow, plus other arch enemies of the individual comic-based Super Friends. Amazing stuff to know.
It is interesting. And, like, I am surprised characters like Penguin and Abracadabra. Oh, not Penguin. I'm sorry. He was Batman type, but like Abracadabra, the fact that he got dropped.
Yeah, he got dropped for no good reason. Yeah.
Well, I guess because they had Captain Cold in there. You know, like, probably they said, okay, Flash gets one villain only. I guess I don't know. So. Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. We heard from Bucky749. It says, hey, just wondering, I know He-Man was part of DC for a while. Is there a DC Who's Who on He-Man or something similar? That's a good question. Subgum Doug responded, not by DC, but in 2002 to 2004, the rival of He-Man did produce a comic from the publisher CrossGen that was titled Master of the Universe Encyclopedia Season 1. And it was a Who's Who type reference book. It didn't refer to the 80s version of He-Man, though, but rather the 2002 version. And only one of the five issues actually came out. He says, I think that Mattel nixed the project before issue 2 could see the light of day. So if you track down the issue, you could read a Who's Who-esque entries on characters like Beastman and Clawful because they happen to have alphabetically advantageous names. Wow. Thank you, Subgum Dunk. Interesting information.
There should be like Who's Who catalogs of toy lines. That would be cool, right? Like your Masters of the Universe Who's Who edition, but except the photos are of the toys.
Okay. So
the histories of the characters. That'd be really neat.
I'm going off the reservation a bit here, but something struck me today, and I don't know where else I'm going to share it with like-minded people. I'm going to flip the script to Marvel for a second in Ohotmu, which is obviously the parallel to this. How the hell the Marvel Cinematic Universe has not used the Ohotmu concept to springboard something makes no sense. Like, they could do two-minute clips of, like, you know, Ohotmu for Black Widow, and just show lots of clips of her from movies, get a voiceover of Scarlett Johansson saying, you know, I'm Black Widow, I'm 5'9", I was a spy, blah, blah, blah. Just to give a little, you know, here's who this character is. They could call it the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, whatever you want, or Marvel Cinematic Universe, I don't care. And throw them on, I don't know, YouTube, throw them on Disney Plus, whatever, to help also make the Marvel movies a little more approachable to people like, oh, it's movie 24? Okay, I've only seen three of these. You know, It's an idea just waiting to happen. And all it would take is a clip show and a voiceover, and you could do it, and you could use the branding of Ohotmu. So that's my 2 cents.
And then you could get the girls to rate how hot everybody is in it. There you go.
Well, yeah.
This goes on forever. I'm betting Chris Evans scores really high. Brian Chufo says, as a kid, I picked up every issue I could find of Captain Carrot and his Amazing Zoo Crew, starting with issue 8. The clean artwork, the unending puns, the pop culture references edited for Earthsea, and the fun characters were everything I needed at the time. The Crisis on Earthsea Minus two-part series with the Just a Lot of Animals with the cover homage to one of the best floating head covers, Crisis on Earth Prime, was one of my favorites. And then there was a time Gorilla Grodd came over to Earth One and everyone was shocked because he was naked, which he totally is. Why did no one else notice? Was Barry Allen just being polite? At least Monsieur Mallow wears a beret.
I like the bit text on the end. Took the whole conversation in a different direction. I like that.
Really did.
They were from Eric, who says, when you discussed how well the two cheetah images work together with their poses almost mirroring each other, I realized the likely reason for it. Trina Robbins and Steve Lalohal are married, and they would have easily been able to coordinate their pages to work together as a match pair. I already knew that Robbins and Lalohal were a married couple, but it didn't occur to me until this podcast that it was probably wasn't a coincidence that the two of them drew the two cheetahs. Look at that. And then my buddy Gus Casals, who does the Ian Reed's Crisis podcast, the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast, and more, he came out and basically to say the same thing. So, yeah. So thank you to Eric and thank you to Gus.
Yeah, I knew that, but I didn't think of it in the time. Nope. And we should, of course, mention in since between that episode and this, Trina Robbins has passed away. Very unfortunate. He's just an immense talent in comics and did a lot for comics history and a lot of giving voice to women creators and things like that. And just to throw it into my, you know, another one of my personal, you know, fandoms, she had a sort of fanzine that featured women art, women artists, women creators on women characters. And it was called Innate Me Babe, which of course is borrowing from the Bob Dylan song. So rest in peace, Trina Robbins. Just a great, great talent. Matt Sirois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast says, first off, I've totally got Shag's back when he says JSA was the best superhero comic of the 2000s.
Woo-hoo!
I'm willing to let Shag fight anyone who disagrees. This episode starts with a bang, featuring a gorgeous rendition of Batwoman, and follows with an even bigger kapow with Cheetah. The Guy Gardner pose is very reminiscent of the pose Moon Knight held in the corner box of his first solo series. They both definitely look like they're about to give you the finger.
I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. All right. Hey, and thanks for getting my back on that. JSA represent. Then we're here from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as the JLU Cast, Power Records, and more. And he brings up some interesting facts about Fastback. Because, you know, we talked about, and today even too, how the Turtles just don't get any recognition. I'm sorry, not Turtles. I'm sorry. The Captain Carrot crew don't get recognition outside of that. So he says Fastback's uncle is McSnurtle the Turtle, a.k.a. the Terrific What's It, who is a funny animal parody of Jay Garrick Flash, who appeared all the way back in Funny Stuff 1 through 17 in the 1940s. His costume looked just like Jay's, except he had a circle behind a lightning bolt predating the Barry Allen uniform. So that's fascinating. The McSnurtle the Turtle, the Terrific What's It, was a Golden Age parody of Jay Garrick, and Fastback is his nephew. And by the way, I'm bringing all this up because it's going to come back in the conversation in just a second.
Isamu, get on that. Get a listing going, by the way.
Oh, my gosh. No, that's not where I'm going, but go ahead.
Okay. By the way, I love Chris writes out the randomizer, the boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 boop. He actually types it out. I really appreciate it. He writes, don't forget Ma Hunkel's granddaughter Cyclone appeared in Black Adam. I did forget that because I blotted out that movie as it was happening to me, Chris. So therefore, I have actually no memory of that film at all.
I remember because Cyclone was really cool in the movie. So regardless of how the movie was, Cyclone was a great brought to life on the screen. Super Captain chimes in. Okay, so this is where it ties back into the McSnurtle thing. So Super Captain writes, Captain Carrot and the Amazing Zoo Crew is one of my favorite series of all time. It's pretty astounding that in this day and age of a myriad of media representations of superheroes, Fastback and the other zoo crewers have so seldomly appeared. However, Merton the Turtle is in the DC League of Super Pets movie, paid homage to Fastback's uncle, Merton McSnurtle, a.k.a. the Terrific What's It from the Golden Age. Woof, that's a lot. Okay, so I don't know how that worked. I didn't see DC League of Super Pets, but I like the idea that Merton the Turtle must be, and maybe it's just the name is paying homage then to Merton McSnurtle, the Terrific What's It. These names are so hard to say. But I love that there is some connective tissue still to that Golden Age character, which then thereby, by association, is sort of kind of connected to Captain Carrot. So thank you, Super Captain, for sharing that. And he says, the one criticism I would have of the Zoo Crew is total lack of monkey or ape characters on the team. And I rack my brain. I'm like, huh. But all I can think is, you know, ideally, if you follow the concepts of evolution, we're descended from, you know, apes. So maybe that's why they didn't do it, because apes are connected to humans. I don't know. Then we're from Ido Bosnar, who says, Ragman is one of my favorite characters, but specifically the street-level, mostly non-superhero Ragman from the original 1970s. I've read about the way they retooled him later and just dislike the concept so much that I have no interest in reading it. Wow, I was not ready for that comment, Ido, because, like, for me, I'm the flip side. I love the new version so much. The old version is just like, oh, you know, that's cute, but it's, you know, the old school. And so I was surprised by your comment liking, and I think it's fantastic that you love it that much. I love that we have different opinions. And actually, you're not the only one. Other people chimed in that they prefer the original Ragman too, which is, I think, really cool to have these diverse opinions. And he says, Ma Hunkel is the only Red Tornado I like. I was happy to learn that she was brought back in the post-2000s JSA series, just as I'm always delighted when she comes up in any conversation. Yeah, I absolutely love Ma Hunkel. And you know what? Just for you, Ido, Ma Hunkel, Ma Hunkel, Ma Hunkel. So there we go. Then we're from Alan Boyce. It says about Toyman. You know, when I always say like where you can find more in a character, he pointed out that Toyman is a TV star. Schott was the father of one of the main characters on the Supergirl series. There was a character named Win Schott, who was a regular in the first couple seasons, or first season, whichever, and Toyman was his dad. There's an episode where the description of the episode is Win's father, a supervillain named Toyman, escapes from prison and contacts his son. And he also goes on to say there's other stuff in the description, and Maxwell Lord's in the same episode. So you can see Toyman and Maxwell Lord in the same episode of Supergirl. What the world we live in is insane.
I'd say amazing, but it isn't anymore. You know,
right? We've like become really, numb to it.
What are we just talking about? Turtle McSnurtle was referenced in a movie. Like what? You know, what is left to be excited about?
The Ghost Patrol, damn it!
Yeah, the Ghost Patrol. Would-be world conqueror Siskoid from this very network leaves a comment. He says, "Batwoman, as I was told after we covered her on Who's Hot and Who's Not, or the Ohotmu or Not feed." On the Ohotmu or not feed, excuse me. She doesn't have a bat symbol because the way she was drawn in the 50s, the play of black and yellow on her chest didn't leave room for it. She sort of had a black bustier, but the way it was interpreted by modern artists, it just became shadow, and suddenly she has a blank yellow shirt. I don't know. I understand. It makes total sense. I still disagree with it because they should just do it anyway, but yes.
Bruce Wayne's all about the branding. He wasn't going to give up that copyright.
There you go.
He wasn't willing to pay the licensing fee. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. We talked a lot about crypto, and I mentioned how all there's these post-crisis cryptos. He goes, oh, yeah, of all those post-crisis cryptos, at one point there was a giant lizard dog. I had forgotten about that one. Thank you. And he says, I noticed that in the comments, when you lads chat, Crypto and Snoopy always live in a doghouse. Do you American folks not use the word kennel? So, Martin, over here, kennel typically represents, like, in my mind, one of two things. Either a metal chain link, you know, cage for a dog to sit in, which is, as a dog owner, doesn't really leave you with any warm fuzzies. Or a kennel might represent, like, if you're transporting the dog to the vet, you put him in, like, a what we might call a kennel or a carrier of some sort, depending on the size of your dog, in order to transport them. So that's kind of our use of the word kennel. That's fair to say, Rob?
That's funny. I always thought the word kennel is a place where you board your dog.
Okay, well, I mean, yeah, that's the chain link fence kind of thing I'm talking about.
Okay,
too,
but all right. But that sounds like something you're carrying. I'm saying to me, a kennel is a destiny, a business that you take your dog to. And, you know, for whatever reason, you can't keep your dog for a couple of days and you leave it there at a kennel and then you come back and get it, presumably.
Okay. Yeah, over here, what you see Crypto and Snoopy have, we call those dog houses.
Yeah, we call them dog houses. Yep.
All right. And then Martin also says he prefers the original Ragman. The modern one looks too much like a mucky specter, and I like the original power set more than the spooky, ooky stuff. The modern chap was good in Shadow Pack, though. The original treatment logo was brilliant. It was like the DC production department had photographed rags and cut them out into letters. Modern series tend to use the patches, which is a waste. Interesting. But again, I'm fascinated to find people like the original Ragman better. I'm not saying they're wrong. It's just completely different from my opinion. And I find that fascinating. He says, I loved Thriller. Here you go, Rob, the one guy. I love Thriller. I bought every issue and pretended to understand it. It's such a shame that whatever Robert Loren Fleming's long-term plan was, it vanished when he and Trevor Von Eden left. Bill Dubay kept the comic entertaining, though. And yes, Alex Nino art was typically lovely.
I think I read it one or two into the Dubay Nino run, and then I got even more confused. I was just like, all right, I'm out. that book was like $1.25 back then, that was a lot of money.
Break the bank?
Yeah. Noah Tarnow from the Big Quiz Thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast, says, I never read Thriller, they're contrary to Martin, but I do remember being a frequent target of jokes in the first couple of Ambush Bug miniseries. An AB profile written as if he were a Playboy centerfold says his idea of romantic evening involves feeding issues of Thriller into a paper shredder. I remember that joke. Of course, this is because Thriller co-creator Robert Fleming also wrote Ambush Bug with Keith Giffen. So, good for you, Robert Lord Fleming, a sense of humor.
I read those Ambush Bug stories. I haven't read them in years, but I read them very early in my DC career. So like a lot of these jokes I didn't even understand, but still found them funny. Like making fun of Thriller, I found hilarious, even though I didn't even understand what Thriller was. I just knew it was a book that didn't sell. So fascinating
before,
stuff.
Okay, before we move off of that, just like you say, when else am I going to mention this? In that same joke, right, that same Ambush Bugs Playboy centerfold information sheet, right? they ask him for his favorite movies. And one of the movies he lists is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And I remember this was in like 84 when that came out.
Probably. So
I would have been 13. I've, as everyone knows, I love Abbott and Costello. I've always loved Abbott and Costello. I loved them as a kid. I love them as an adult. But as I grew up, like I got a little older, I was always like, oh, well, that's like, that's kind of not considered good. I like it, but it, like no one else likes it. And that was the first thing I could think of in pop culture where someone was singling Abbott and Costello out as like, no, this is actually really good. And I remembered feeling like, oh, the Ambush Bug guys get me because they love Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein too.
Is Ambush Bug really the guy you want in your corner saying that you have good taste?
I was 13, you know? I mean, I just was excited to see it mentioned in a non-derogatory way in anything, especially something I liked as much as Ambush Bug.
By the way, I have to mention, again, the world we live in, you can right now pre-order your Ambush Bug action figure that comes with a Cheeks the Toy Wonder accessory.
It's just ridiculous. It's just, I mean, I know I say ridiculous, I mean great.
Yes. They were heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, aw, Ma Hunkle. She was a fun character. I almost wish she and Forbush Man from Marvel had a crossover. That's fantastic. They both wear pots in their heads. That would be hysterical.
That actually is a pretty funny idea.
They can make spaghetti together. Yeah. I love it.
And then she undoes all that with saying, next, Thriller. Meh. Looks like a low-rent A-team. Next. Brutal. That's brutal.
But not wrong.
Not wrong, but brutal.
They were from Brian Lenton. It says, as plausible as Siskoid's explanation sounds, we all know the real reason why Batwoman doesn't have a bat symbol on her costume. Batman has that symbol. Batman has that symbol trademarked. Yep. And he charges a pretty penny for its use. In the end, Kathy Kane had to choose between a bat symbol or a small circus. And she went on to the more affordable option. That's right, because her entry mentions she bought a circus. Oh, Brian, that was an amazing setup for a great payoff, man. I forgot about the circus. Yeah, she couldn't afford the bat symbol, so she bought a circus instead.
I do love the idea of that's how Batman has been so wealthy, is that he's just licensing his bat stuff to people. That's a really good idea.
I don't know whether you guys are getting funnier or I'm just getting more tired, but I'm just cracking
it up. It's very late. Dr. Ange from Supergirl blog, Comic Books Commentary, and the Legion of Super Blogger says, Cheetah. Wow, what an entry. As someone whose heart belongs to Josie of Pussycat fame, this is the type of bad girl that a naive Ange would pine for. The art the art is crazy good in terms of the top level minimalism. There is no doubt there is some craziness in her eyes. Perfect. And then he's going to bag on Thriller. Thriller, glorious mess is a perfect description. Would you be shocked to know I have number one signed by Trevor Von Eden? No, I would not be shocked by that.
Narrator says no. They're from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network. He has shows like Terminator Now Podcast, his comic reader resume, and a whole bunch more. He says, I swear, creating Kane and then bringing back Kathy Kane? DC is getting as bad as Marvel about redundancy related to an inability to let anything go. I don't know that that's a bad thing, Frank. I mean, I don't know. We have two Flashes, three Flashes running around. Why can't we have two Kate Kanes, Kathy Kanes? I don't know. He says, Crypto's another thing that works with Superboy, but not Superman. But instead of the adventures of young Kal-El, we get five other Superboys. And this is why I don't read DC or Marvel anymore. Well, he's grumpy today. But I will say you're right. Crypto, in my
today.
Opinion, Crypto does not work without Superboy. I agree. He does not work with Superman. I don't get it. And he says, since the first airing, I have skimmed Thriller for who's editing. I don't recommend doing that. All right. They went from Symbol Pending from the has their own Power Girl blog called Symbol Pending. It says, I am contractually obligated to mention that Power Girl met the Zoo Crew in Crisis on Earth C-, and that it was her that the current Toyman insisted on a date in order to help out Superman and Batman. Boy, that's not creepy at all. Then Symbol Pending goes on to say, talking of soft spots, I unironically love Ma Hunkle, even before she joined the JSA. And technically, she's DC's first female superhero, because Diana did not appear until 1942, something I will continue to celebrate, even if I'm completely wrong. Then he says, she was indeed a supporting character in Scribbly. I read some of those old All-American comics, and let's say some of them haven't aged as well as we'd like. Ooh, okay. Thanks for the warning, Symbol Pending.
I think we can guess what that might be. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Shag. Always entertaining to hear the FW Godfathers chatting it up. a solid array of Who's Who entries. The Batwoman art was nice, but come on, DC. That costume is really putting her at a disadvantage. Loitering a purse while wearing high heels? It would be like if I had to fight some local toughs while carrying a pizza. He paints such an image with his emails. The Sportsmaster is playing some sick air guitar. It was always wild watching him nail a hero with an eight ball and then turn around and smack another with a hockey stick. Good stuff. He is an evil villain, though, so I can only assume he's a Dallas Cowboys and Boston Celtics fan. I don't know sports at all, but I got that joke nonetheless, Brett.
I got to say, I unironically love the Sportsmaster. It's just his gimmick.
Yeah, he's great.
So goofball. They have found ways to make him work in various places, in animation and live action. I love the character. Yep. So we may have to do a Sportsmaster special for Justice Society Presents. Anyway, then we're from Mike Dinas, who says, Fastback, so good. I love, love, love Scott Shaw's art and the Zoo Crew, the puns, the all-age stories, all of it. And so the others have mentioned above, the Crisis on Earth C-minus is a particular favorite story. You know, I'm so happy that there's people out there, guys, that love Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew. I know Rob and I, we love the concepts. We struggle reading the book itself. But I'm so thrilled to hear that it landed with the right audience. And that's fantastic. Because I want everyone to love everything. And I want that comic to be successful. So I'm so glad to hear that y'all like that series. Then Mike Dinas goes on to say, Guy Gardner, all I got from this is that Shag likes jerks. Oh, okay. Fair enough. With that, I'll just say, Mike Dinas, I like you too. So, you know, do the formula there. Okay. Then we hear from John Stibe. I'm not sure, John, if I'm saying that right. But anyway, he says, I want to mention how much fun I've had listening to Shag and Rob keep the spirit of DC's Who's Who alive all these past many years. I spent many a days on the riding mower during COVID before and after laughing at your comments about how hot characters like Dolphin was and how composite Superman was Zamort. And then John says he's not. And he says, I've never wanted to read Captain Fear comics more in my life. And the Western Johnny Thunder, too. You guys were and are amazing as well. Thanks for all the fun times. Aww, John, that was incredibly kind. Thank you so much for saying all that.
Very nice.
Then, folks, this is the part of the show where we thank all of you who shared the show on your social media timeline. This means Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. All you got to do is share it on Facebook, retweet it on Twitter, and whatever the hell it's called on Blue Sky. It's real simple, takes 2 seconds, and you will get your name on this list. And yes, I know it sounds like a long list of names like out of a phone book, but we want to recognize each one of these people that help promote the show. So each and every one of these people are an important part of the Who's Who community. And thank you, and apologies to anyone we might have missed. Thank you to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Boyce, Andre TFG, Bill Beer, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook page, Brian Schufo, Canadian Geek, Chris Franklin, Chris Lydon, Chuck Rodriguez, Cindy Womack, Coffee and Comics, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Doug Adamson, Dr. Pulp Culture, Ed Moore, Eldon Edwards, John Steeb, J.P. Rocha, Justice League Revisited, Keechee Baker,
Con L, Lizanne Oswalt, Lucien Dazar, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Max Romero, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Movie Matt Royce, Nick Lenz, Patrick Link, Paul Kien, Polite Angels Thesis, Prairie Justice, the Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Richard Field, Scott X, Siskoid, Willie Yarborough, and Zek Cap Boots. One last thing before we move off this, Shag, you mentioned a phone book. You realize beyond a certain age, no one knows what the hell that you're even talking about?
Okay, first, A, quit making me feel old. B,
I mean, this crowd, the crowd that's listening to the show, they know what you're talking about.
we're covering a comic that was published in 1985, so these people know what phone books are. But yes, stop making me feel old. You're probably right. My 18-year-old daughter has no idea that
what a what what like, you know.
Oh God, that's terrible. I can't believe that. Okay, all right. Well, this is normally the part where we go, next time we're not going to tell you, but guess what? We are going to tell you, because next time, folks, you are going to get a Justice League International flashback episode coming later this month. Again, it will be here on the Who's Who feed and on the JLI feed. Check it out there. Featuring, again, a brand new Zooms Who entry by Osamu Yukinori that you are not going to want to miss, because it is one hell of a piece. All right. So, Rob, another one of the books, man. This has been fun. I'm loving Who's Who Review.
Me too. I guarantee we'll be back in 2 months, because I guarantee we will not be moving again in the next 2 months. So.
Awesome. Well, with that, folks, I just want to say until next time,
Who's next?
Never gonna get that right.
I were pretty close that time, I thought.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
And he was a hero for a while there. And that's just messed up. That's weird. Because, like, if you know the history of this dude, you're like, no, not that guy. And he's had a zillion appearances since. Because, I mean, I guess Millennium made him a real household name.